You are called by the chief witness. I hope you understand that I am then have to wait until she allows to be released. The apologies we have is from Honorable Mofokeng, Honorable Meshwe. The deputy minister will join us later. There are cabinet meetings today. And then the Minister of Police has apologized because he is in a cabinet meeting today. Honorable members, could we have a second for the apologies before I welcome the judge? Do we have additional apologies?
Chairperson, may I want to raise something else first? Can we maybe arrive at a point where, you know, the confusion about the time that we're going to meet is going to be solved finally? You know, in the documentation that we got a while ago, it was indicated that the meeting starts at 9. You know, only to see in the Z's list this morning it's 9:30. And now we are given a list again, it's 9:30. Chairperson, we really, our time is valuable. We need to attend to other things as well. We cannot, you know, come here unnecessarily early. That is the first point that I want to raise. Chairperson, then I have, you know, like I mentioned, you know, in the previous meeting that we had, I have serious concerns that we're going to start without the minister or the deputy minister. And as the meeting is going to progress, you will see why I'm raising. I want to put it on record here because I'm seriously concerned. You know, we must decide whether we are serious about the things that we are doing here or not. I'll leave it at that, Chairperson, for now. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Members. I do note this. Honorable Members, I would like to ask Honorable Members if the WhatsApp system is not effective, because on the 11th we sent a message that the meeting will start at 9:30. So some members indicated that they got the message. So if the WhatsApp group is not working, Honorable Majozi indicated that she got the message. So if our WhatsApp group is not working, then I will expect the administrators to inform members individually and not depend on the WhatsApp group. Could I accept that we should be informed individually and not on the WhatsApp group?
Chairperson, thank you. I think we must just choose one uniform way of communication. It must be consistent, because once you have two different times, it sows doubt in our minds as to which is the most accurate information. Hence, in order to avoid embarrassment of us arriving at 9:30, when the meeting started at 9, we got here at 8:45 this morning. That's fine, we had coffee, nice chat, but the bottom line is we had this issue last week with the DPCI judge. We had miscommunication. The committee arrived at 9, the judge arrived at 9:30, the judge was told 9:30, we were told 9 o'clock. It is your responsibility, Chair, not the secretary's of the committee's responsibility. It is your responsibility to make sure that this committee is a professional committee that abides by consistent times when we are supposed to meet, whether it's 9 o'clock or 9:30. We need to be clear in our minds, because people fly in, people fly out. We arrange early morning meetings, and I think it's just clear on everybody on the committee that we have a regular time that we meet. And if it's going to be 9:30, then we all know it's 9:30. We don't have two different times. The other thing I think that the committee needs an explanation on, Chairperson, is that when we met some time ago with IPED on the annual report, we were told that IPED would table a report on the manipulation of statistics in Parliament. That meeting was scheduled for today. That meeting was changed. I'm very appreciative to have the DNA Board and the Civilian Secretariat here today, because that's also a long, outstanding appointment. But there is no reason why this committee could not deal with both issues today. And I get the distinct feeling that the ticking a box, arriving, and leaving as quickly as possible. And I'm afraid that that doesn't sit well with me. And I'd like to know why we can't deal with the IFID letter today, and whether we're only going to be dealing with the adoption of minutes next week, or whether IFID will be coming back next week. I think if we can get that clarity at the outset, I think we can have a very productive meeting and future meetings going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Whitfield. I do attempt to have things running smoothly, and I think the Secretariat would attest to that. The behind the scenes battling, I don't think, to the committee. Especially also the times, I've also indicated my concern about it changing the times. Could we all agree that the meetings will start at 9:30? That the meetings will start at 9:30. I'm not going to give explanations. I'm not going to accept any further changes to that. Could we agree to 9:30?
Agree.
The second one is that, could we agree that the I have also been extremely annoyed. IPED has once more requested for a postponement. And the only opportunity they will have is to come to us next week, and we will not grant them any further postponement. And I have indicated that. So, Honourable Whitfield, I think as far as possible, I don't try to bring what happens outside of the meeting in terms of our arrangements. My most sincere apologies to the judge that we got our times wrong. If you were inconvenienced, I had to unfortunately arrive a few minutes late today. I take responsibility because I arrived late. The chief whip, I think when she also calls you at very short notice, then there's very little you can do if the chief whip calls you. And it isn't party political matters, but I happen to also be the chairperson of the peace and stability cluster. So if there is an immediate concern related to the cluster, then you can understand why the chief will call us in urgently. So I respect the responsibilities of the chief. Needless to say, could we agree that IPED will give us their report next week? Honourable Whitfield.
Thank you.
If that is all, I would like to welcome the DNA board and Madam Judge, Your Excellency. It's the first time we have you in the committee. Accept that we have the highest regard for your work, and that this is a committee who works with you. We are not here to understand reports. We do interrogate your reports, and we work as a collective. We understand that the matter of peace and stability is not a party political matter. It is a matter which affects all of us as a country. With that, honourable members and the honourable DNA board, welcome and thank you very much for being here. I'll immediately hand over to you, Honourable Judge, and you could indicate who will do the presentation.
Thank you so much, Honourable Chair. Thank you so much for the warm welcome. We are pleased to be here today to present to brief the committee on our annual report. And this is the first time that we do that to this committee. And I had thought we will honor you with the presence of the full board. And however, I'm disappointed that not all members of the board are here today. We know that we had an appointment to present our report on the 6th of November, and unfortunately, that notice was for us too short, considering that, as you know, legislatively, this is a board constituted of part-time people who elsewhere have full-time jobs, and it's always very difficult to come together at such short notice. But we appreciated that this honorable committee was gracious enough to give us a postponement from the 6th to today. And today, just by sheer chance, happens to be the date on which we were supposed to meet to have a board meeting. And we were happy to have the meeting, the briefing postponed to that date, thinking that we'll have a full complement of members, and here we are. We still only have 2, 4, 6 members of the board and officials. Five members of the board, pardon, and officials. But that shouldn't make a difference to our presentation. We appreciate the fact that we are here, not just to present our report and go away. It's subjecting ourselves to scrutiny. And that is the role that this committee must play. And it also stands us in good stead to be scrutinized, because then we know how to do things better. Without further ado, I will just, after this opening, get our director to introduce the idea of the report, and then the deputy chairperson will present it. And then we will expect questions from the committee, and in that question and answer section, we hope we will be able to engage with each other in a way that places the board in a position to account for the work that it has done during this reporting period. Because that is what we're going to present to the Honorable Committee. We have before you, of course, myself as chairperson of the board, and then we have the deputy chairperson of the board, Vanessa Lynch. And then we have Mr. Rapia, who is also, although he's the secretary of the CSPS, he's also a member of the board, and he sits here as a member of the board. And then we have Alida, a member of the board, all civilians. No, Alida represents his health. And then we have Karen L. She is a civilian member. Vanessa Lynch is also civilian. And we have the director of the board, who is the secretariat of the board. And then we have the CFO, who serves also the board as the financial person. So these are the people who come from the DNA board. And we are here to be subjected to scrutiny after we have presented our report. The report will be introduced by our director, and then, as I said, the deputy chairperson will present. Thank you, Madam Chair. I almost said my lady.
Thank you, Judge. Honorable Chair, honorable members, as indicated, my name is Mark Rogers. I'm the director of the DNA Board Secretariat. The report that will be presented today really just provides a synopsis of the key activities of the board for the 2018-19 reporting period. It looks at some of the key challenges that the board encountered over the period, which the Deputy Chair will allude to. Some of the worrying trends that the board had picked up in relation to the performance of the Forensic Science Lab and the National Forensic DNA Database specifically, some of the interventions that the board had attempted to put in place to deal with some of those challenges and where we sit to date. Also around the amendments to certain pieces of legislation that the board felt would be necessary in order to support the effective functioning of the database and also to support the more effective implementation of the Act and supporting regulations. And also just to have a general discussion around some of the prevailing challenges that the board has encountered, but I believe the Deputy Chair will take you through that. So, yeah, without further ado, I'll hand over to the Deputy Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Good morning, and Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, and thank you for the opportunity to allow the CMA Board to present to you this morning. As Mark has just really gone over an overview of what's going to be presented today, just please bear in mind that as we go through the presentation, this is the reporting period that ended in March 2019. So there have been a number of progressions since that time, which I will allude to because you do need to have some context in terms of what has happened. But I will indicate that at the time, just so that you don't walk away with a sense that that is what's currently happening. And then obviously there will be a couple of proposals towards the end that the judge would like to, at the end of my presentation, just put forward to the board, because I'm sure there will be quite a few questions around some of the items I'll be presenting this morning. And the judge's proposals may just provide some context to how we have considered those going forward before the end of our tenure, which is happening in January of next year. As it's the first time we are presenting to this particular committee, we just thought a brief overview in terms of what our role is. As you are aware, we have been formed in terms of the DNA Act, or the Criminal Law Forensic Procedures Amendment Act, which was promulgated in 2015. The board's role is really twofold. First is that we have ethical oversight over the National Forensic DNA Database. And the second is that we have a role in terms of the implementation of the provisions of the DNA Act. And obviously in the first 5 years, there has been a lot of work in terms of ensuring that the implementation and the transitional phase, and you'll all be aware there's a transitional paragraph in the Act, have been adhered to, and we've hoped to have assisted in a number of those challenges. And part of those is that we have to make recommendations to the Minister in terms of proposals of amending the Act, which we have already done and will continue to do until such time as our tenure is over. We have provided oversight over not only the collection and of the DNA samples, but also in terms of the forensic DNA database. Each index of the forensic DNA database has specific retention frameworks, and it is our duty to ensure that those have been adhered to. We also have the role of receiving and assessing any complaints, which fortunately to this date, we haven't received any notice of any complaints or breach of the National Forensic DNA Database, which is obviously a really good thing, but that is our role in terms of the ethical oversight of the DNA database. More importantly is that this forensic DNA database has been established in terms of the DNA Act for the first time ever. And its use is only for the purposes of criminal intelligence, the fight against crime, which we are all too aware has reached epidemic proportions currently. And that the forensic DNA database is just an incredible methodology to identify people involved in the commission of offences. It's a very useful tool to not only prove people's innocence, but as well as guilt, and more importantly, is exoneration. We also are able to use this database for the identification of missing persons and unidentified human remains. And I would like you to just bear this in mind, because some of the recommendations we have made to the Minister in terms of the amendment to the Act, one needs to consider the purpose of the DNA Act, which really is sitting right here, and that we need to ensure as the Oversight Board that we continue to adhere to the original purpose of the DNA database in terms of the DNA Act. To start off with situational analysis, this is essentially what our key initiatives have been for this reporting period. And in order to do that, the DNA board does engage with various stakeholders in order to ensure that we are implementing the Act in the way in which it was originally perceived to have been implemented when it was promulgated. The first was that we looked at an amendment to the Act following the expiration of the convicted offender sampling program. Initially, and I'm not sure if any of the members were here at the time of the build-up to the DNA Act, the convicted offenders index is a very important part of the forensic DNA database insofar as it has the ability to not only connect particular individuals to cold cases, which haven't yet been solved, but it also has the ability to ensure that in the future that you are able to immediately identify a perpetrator if they are involved in future crimes after leaving any retention facility. And with a high rate of reoffending or recidivism in this country, this is obviously a very useful tool and one which is much needed. The initial proposal was that within 2 years, this population group in terms of the index, the convicted offender population, if we can call it that, needed to be sampled within 2 years, and the previous portfolio committee put that in place because they wanted to ensure that it was done as fast as possible. Unfortunately, due to various issues around situations such as the way in which the Department of Correctional Services as well as the Department of Police registered the convicted offenders, they weren't able to interface those identification numbers as well as training of the police in terms of sample taking. So this program started a lot later than envisaged, with a result that it expired before the convicted offender population was in fact sampled and put onto the National Forensic DNA Database. The board, in response to this, recommended an extension to this, naturally because the convicted offender index is such an important part of the forensic DNA database. This unfortunately has not taken place and has been put on hold, and we'll go into that a little bit later because there is specifically a slide around that. But the minister has indicated that he would prefer to have a much wider population on our current forensic DNA database, which is why the specific recommendation for an amendment has not yet been promulgated. But I will, there is a particular slide, and I'll correct later, that deals with that. The amendments to the regulations were also proposed by the DNA board, and this was in response to the forensic investigative lead. A forensic investigative lead is essentially when a profile on the DNA database, an unknown, which is a crime scene profile, is linked to more than one particular scenario or case. So what you would find is that you might have 6 different rapes, for instance. They don't know who committed those rapes, but they can see from the analysis of that crime scene sample, which were collected from the different rapes, which happened in different locations, that they're dealing with the same profile, which indicates that it's the same perpetrator. This obviously is criminal intelligence, in that if that is given, information is given back to an investigating officer, they are able to realize that it's a serial offender and derive criminal intelligence, such as modus operandi or where they're operating or any other information that they otherwise may not have been able to connect had they not known that it was the same perpetrator. The DNA regulations, what they were doing in terms of strengthening these forensic investigative leads was ensuring that they actually are followed up, because it's such a powerful tool, and if they don't have the resources and they don't actually have task forces that collect all this information and one person or one task force then goes and follows up all the different cases, the potential of that is that they're lost and those serial offenders continue to perpetrate crime, more often than not violence against women, because a number of those are actually rapes. And we use the opportunity to actually apprehend that particular individual, which is why these regulations really do need to give impetus and resources to these task teams, because they do such a good job. We have also, in terms of the board's governance, it's quite a complex structure, and I think that at the time, or we think that at the time that the Act was promulgated, it wasn't necessarily considered that a number of these challenges would be encountered in terms of the governance. And in terms of this, we have had difficulty, because we're not an independent board and because we are funded by the CSP, and we don't have an enforceable mandate and we report to the Minister of Police, there have been difficulties understanding what our role is and how far we can take that role. As a result, there have been challenges that have been experienced by the board and the CSP in this regard, and we have looked at many different ways as to how to overcome them. What we were finding is that a number of our board meetings were very difficult to convene due to the fact that board members have full-time jobs, is that they were burdened with administrative talk, so to speak, in terms of how we can overcome these challenges. So what was proposed was an MOU which essentially really redefined what our roles are and tried to alleviate the potential conflict and the conflict that was arising as a result of these conflictual roles. This MOU hasn't yet been signed, and we're still in the process of finding a way forward, specifically because our tenure in terms of this particular board comes to an end in January 2020. But again, I will refer to the fact that the judge has a proposal in this regard that even though it's not in this reporting period, does need to be considered going forward, because we do need to talk about this before such time as our tenure is in fact ended. Notwithstanding these challenges, which I will go into in a little bit more detail further on, the board has continued to direct its efforts at finding solutions to one of the most crippling challenges that we've probably faced in the last couple of years, which has been that we've had a shortage of sampling kits, and this includes not only the evidence collection kits, which is the sexual assault evidence collection kits, which we probably have all heard a lot about in the media, but as well as the sampling kits, so that we haven't been able to even sample the arrestees who are, in terms of the Act, mandated to submit their DNA samples to the police. And you will see that there has been a dramatic decline, and I'll show you the figures a little bit later, in terms of the number of profiles that have been added to the DNA database, which is incredibly sad considering the amount of work and resources that have been allocated to building the DNA database and the potential that it has in terms of fighting crime. The sexual offender data, in terms of there's a specific database of sexual offenders in this country, has been very problematic in terms of, again, interfacing the information on the National Forensic DNA database with the information held on that registry. And that, in terms of that particular mandate that we have in order to ensure that all profiles on the sexual offender register, or all persons on the sexual offender register, are in fact entered onto the National Forensic DNA database, has to date not been achieved, although it remains a priority because these interfaces simply haven't been resolved. And until such time as you have two systems speaking the same language, you are never going to be able to integrate the two in the way in which it was originally envisaged. And again, with legislation, the complexities of these kind of challenges aren't necessarily realized at the time, but when you are trying to implement them, they become clear, and that's where the board has had to try and oversee and facilitate the integration of these challenges. I won't go too much into the slide, simply because the judge has introduced the members that are there and has introduced and has indicated why some of the members aren't here, but specifically because they do have full-time jobs. And again, this has also been one of the many challenges as a board that we've experienced, trying to get 10 people together with full-time jobs and different agendas has been essentially very problematic. And I think also undermines the work of the DNA board and how effective that we would like to be, but unfortunately, with these kind of challenges in place, it does become quite difficult going forward. Initially, when the board first convened, we decided that because of the structure of it, because we had 10 people doing sort of different things, we created subcommittees. And these subcommittees actually initially were very effective. Since the appointment of the secretariat, they have to some extent fallen away, primarily because the work of the subcommittees
was largely what we had hoped would largely be taken over by the director, and going forward, the deputy director who's been appointed will also assist in that process. But the reason that subcommittees were convened was because there were different aspects of the BNA board that had to be looked at, such as systems reports and gaps analysis, essentially the information that is received by the Forensic Science Laboratory to the DNA board. We had to interrogate that information. For instance, if they say from last year to this year we've only loaded X number of profiles, and there's a drop in the number of profiles from the previous year, we need to interrogate that to understand why has there been a drop in the number of profiles. Is it training? Is it procurement of kits? How can we intervene to assist this? Public relations is just how we interact with the public, which really there hasn't been much on that front in terms of that subcommittee. Training has been a very important subcommittee, and we do have representation on the board here today, and that have enough police being trained in order to take samples from convicted offenders as well as from arrestees and persons of interest. The complaints committee haven't needed to meet because we haven't to date received any complaints. The finance and risk is essentially in terms of what do we do with our budget? Are we utilising it in the correct manner, and are the funds being utilised in the correct way in which it should, in terms of facilitating the board's progress? Transitional arrangements, I did mention initially the DNA Act has a specific paragraph that deals with the transitional arrangements, such as the convicted offender sampling program, as well as the implementation of CODIS, which is the DNA database software solution that needs to be put into place in the Forensic Science Laboratory, as well as the changing of the profiles from the old system onto the new system. So that has been very much part of the board overseeing, have these transitional arrangements taken place, and what have we done to facilitate them. And finally, human resources, the appointments of the director, and more recently, the appointment of the deputy director, in order to facilitate the work of the board, because we are only able to meet on a part-time basis. So if you look here at the analysis, and we get these statistics directly from the Forensic Science Laboratory. Bear in mind that when we meet as a board, which is on a quarterly basis, the normal sort of construct of the meeting is that the board meets in the morning, we have a lunch break, and then we then meet with the Forensic Science Laboratory, as well as various stakeholders who are involved with the implementation of the Act. For instance, if it's training, or if it's in respect of procurement, or if it's with the Bid Adjudications Committee, or public relations, we then in the afternoon meet with all of those stakeholders in order to interrogate the information that we've given to us just prior to that meeting. What you can see here is that consider that the Act was promulgated in January 2015, the initial loading of forensic DNA data profiles was enormous. It was a very successful start. The resources that had been allocated to the implementation of the Act were available to the Forensic Science Laboratory. The procurement in terms of the sampling kits, in terms of the maintenance contracts, in terms of the consumables that were necessary in order to process the samples in the Forensic Science Laboratory, the training that was given to the PEP, was all happening. And with the results of that, and if you look back on those reports, you will read into them too, there was an exponential growth of the DNA database. And as we understand it, the more profiles you have on a DNA database, the greater the chance of you linking it to an unknown or a crime scene profile. And more often than not, it's a serial offender. And that is why it's such a powerful tool, is that you can often link somebody that otherwise looks unrelated to a number of crimes that are being committed, and you can save lives by taking that person out of the system in order that they can't continue to reoffend. So in 2017-2018 reporting year, these numbers started to drop. This is because what started to happen now is that the maintenance and the procurement contracts weren't renewed, and so we started seeing the drop-off in terms of the number of sampling kits available to take samples from a receipt. This then dropped dramatically in the last reporting year because there were simply no kits because the maintenance and the procurement contracts were not being awarded. And I think the Bid Adjudication Committee, and I'll go into it a bit further, I think they met over four times. And again, it's not pointing fingers, there were just too many stakeholders involved with without understanding that the priority was that without these kits, you were having rape survivors coming into rape survivor facilities who weren't able to have crime scene samples collected simply because we haven't had kits. And you weren't able to then take a DNA sample from an arrestee who was a potential subject because the police didn't have kits. So besides the tragedy of that alone, the numbers then dropped, and you can see that the number of profiles that were loaded in the last financial year dropped dramatically. And this will even drop further in the next financial reporting year, because only recently has that maintenance and those procurement kits been awarded, and even then they haven't even delivered the number that still need to be delivered in terms of resourcing all of the facilities and police stations with the necessary sampling kits. In addition to that, we have stopped sampling convicted offenders, and this is also a very important group to populate your DNA database. There is a case of McKee, which we mentioned previously. The only reason this particular person was sampled was because the convicted offender sampling program said that all convicted offenders had to be sampled. He was sampled because he was convicted of an assault, and he was actually linked to over 30 rapes. So he was sampled with an unrelated offense and linked to 30 unsolved rapes, and subsequently he was convicted on that basis. So that is also why those numbers have dropped quite dramatically. Moving forward, it's not in this reporting period, but it has the procurement and the maintenance contracts have been awarded in this more recently in the last few months. So whilst the next financial period won't show that drop, I mean won't show an increase, you will start seeing it slowly starting to rise if these maintenance and award contracts continue to be awarded. And hopefully we don't run into the same problems, or it doesn't take so long to resolve these particular problems. Unfortunately, I did see, and I don't know if you did see, that the budget has been cut for the forensic science laboratory yet again. And it is a very expensive process, but it does need to be resourced, because without being resourced, you cannot give effect to the provisions of the DNA Act, which essentially mean that you need to be putting profiles on the DNA database. So hopefully, the resolution of these kits and consumables will start to exponentially grow the DNA database again. Just in terms of the construct of the DNA database, you can see there the number of profiles currently on the DNA database, and the red indicates the expungement. You will recall that the forensic DNA database only allows the retention, the indefinite retention of profiles of convicted offenders. But if a person has been arrested and subsequently acquitted or released, or for whatever reason that case does not result in a conviction, that profile actually must be removed for those 3 years. So there is this continuous expungement and retention framework based on humanitarian concerns. And again, I refer you to this because when I talk about the amendment and the proposal made by the minister, is that the forensic DNA retention framework on our database is there for human rights considerations. You cannot have an innocent person's profile on the database, only somebody who has had a conviction. There's a limitation of rights in terms of a convicted person. The other indices are only there in terms of utilizing them for different purposes. For instance, an elimination index, if people are working with it, you obviously always want to, if there's contamination, exclude that person from the investigation so as not to confuse it. And obviously the missing persons and unidentified human remains stays there until such time as the case is resolved. So the taking of buccal samples, as I have already indicated, this gives you the actual figures, and the decrease is directly linked to the shortage of kits. The bid adjudication committee had scope were involved, and obviously there were allegations of what they call evergreen contracts, giving the same contract to the same person or only a sole supplier, which scope were looking into. And there were also allegations of corruption and collusion between members of the forensic science laboratory and some of these these contractors. So until such time as they had resolved it, they weren't prepared to award the bid. And the result was that you had the bid adjudication committee, SCOPA, the forensic science laboratory, as well as supply chain management, all sort of fighting different battles, but nobody actually sort of winning the battle, so to speak, because SCOPA wouldn't allow the bid adjudication committee to award it to a particular supplier because they were still under investigation. So everybody was doing their job, and it was just unfortunate that it took so long to ultimately resolve, but fortunately this has been resolved in the next financial year. But this was why there was such a sharp decrease. And in future, and one of the recommendations we did make previously, which we are quite sad didn't happen, is that the portfolio committee probably should have had all of those stakeholders in front of them in the same room to say, okay, how are we going to resolve this? Because it's now become urgent. Because 2 years is a very long time not to have had kits. The knock-on effect of that, which you are going to see next year, is that you're going to start to see backlogs in the laboratory. Because now you're going to have these kits going out, and suddenly all of these sample kits are going to be arriving, and it's going to really put a huge amount of strain on the forensic science laboratory, because now you're not going to be having that continuous process of samples being received. So there is going to be quite a knock-on effect in terms of that. This also meant that new police recruits, in terms of the DNA Act, all new police recruits had to be sampled. And this hasn't been done simply because you have to prioritize. If you've got five kits, are you going to do five new police recruits, or are you going to do five suspected offenders? So there was a prioritization occurring with regards to the sampling when they had surgical kits, and they were literally between provinces giving each other kits where some provinces had more than the others. But this needs to be reactivated, and even now as we speak, the full contingent of sampling kits hasn't yet been delivered to supply chain management, and until such time as that happens, they will probably still be prioritizing the arrestees and suspects, ensuring that they get the sampling kits. But please bear in mind with the next board that this remains a priority, that new SAPS recruits do need to be sampled. It is a very important part of the convicted offender, of the forensic DNA database. We did actually, post this, the chair was able to procure a meeting with the minister, which obviously is not in this reporting period, so it can't be in terms of this report, but just for your information, the chair was able to meet with the minister and put pressure to bear in terms of this, again, to ensure that the stagnant situation that we were in was sort of moved forward, and that a decision had to be made, which ultimately was. The discontinuation of the convicted offender I've spoken about, and obviously due to the myriad of challenges and also training of police officers, weren't able to even get trained, because unless you've got a sample kit to show them how to take samples, and they, again, due to priorities, you can't now go and give brand new sample kits to officers who are being trained to take samples because you want to rather do a suspect. So all of these programs that were in place were put on hold. We want to get to a point where there is enough representation throughout the country to activate Section 36E of the Act. 36E is the mandatory provision which says that all arrestees must have their DNA sample taken. Currently, this is not actually an actionable part of the Act, because there weren't enough trained police officers at the time to ensure that every police station had enough trained officers to actually carry out that instruction in terms of the Act. So the discretionary provision, which says that if they suspect that somebody has been involved in a Schedule 8 offence, they must be sampled. But you obviously want to get to a point where this specific mandatory Act, provision of the Act, is activated and promulgated so that all arrestees have to be sampled when they are arriving at a police station. So you can see through the representation of this graph how it has dropped. You can see that the red represents the number of people that have been scheduled and charged who should have been sampled, versus the numbers that have actually been taken. And there hasn't been a drop in terms of the number of people scheduled in charge. And bear in mind that the successes we were seeing at the the start of the period after the DNA Act was promulgated, the number of successes in terms of identifying serial offenders and resolving cases was exponential too. What's happened is that the number of cases being identified has also dropped as a result of these people not being identified. And there really are a large number of convicted offenders, I mean of suspects who would be identified that aren't, as you can see, are continuing to be released on bail and continuing to reoffend, who we are not able to solve as a result of this. And that really does represent lives, because often it's lives lost because somebody has been released without having been identified as a potential violent offender. The forensic investigative disease I mentioned briefly in the beginning of the presentation, and essentially this is a very important part of the program, because the forensic DNA database is not actually a repository of convicted offenders or people who have a criminal sentence. Or a sentence against them. It really represents investigative leads for the police. How do you link an unknown profile, somebody where you've collected a crime scene sample or a fingerprint, but in this case it's profiles, to a known person? And without the follow-up of those forensic investigative leads, and without people who understand what it is they're receiving, all of that hard work, so everything we've spoken about now in terms of training, in terms of resources, the scientists working in the forensic laboratory, actually goes to nothing unless you're following up those leads. And this is a problem that a number of administrations throughout the world often have just post legislation being passed, is that you need to educate investigators as to the value of what that means. So when you get a report saying this perpetrator could be linked to several offences, please follow it up, they understand the value of that. By establishing task teams whose only job is to collate all of those reports sent to them by the forensic DNA database management team, and all their job is to go and now follow up that, and they have amazing successes. If ever you want to go and talk to some of these task teams, like the one is out in Footrecker Road, they will show you the number of cases they've resolved. The serial offenders that they have been able to identify through the DNA database is really, really phenomenal. So the regulations that we're trying to pass that still haven't been passed, and hopefully they will be passed in the next year or so, give impetus and give resources to these very important task teams who are able to follow up and identify these offenders that have been identified in the database. You can see here, just by representation, is that that shows you the number of unknown suspects or cases or known suspects. So the way in which it works is that sometimes what happens is that the database will say, I don't know who the suspect is, but this particular perpetrator has been linked to 20 cases. Or let's say if I mentioned the McKee case, you will have one person who's identified, so the convicted offender, you know who that person is, and he's been linked to 50 rape cases. What they'll do then is they'll use all that information to build up a case. And obviously, if you're going to go to court and say this perpetrator has been linked to 30 cases versus one alleged rape, you're going to have a very different outcome in terms of the sentence. In conclusion, sorry, I actually thought that, yeah, I'm going to have to, because I need to talk about the amendment, and I thought there was a specific slide to that, but there isn't. So I'm going to talk about it in terms of our conclusion. So, in terms of the challenges faced with a strategic and operational mandate, I did mention that an MOU has been drafted in terms of the different roles and the future of the DNA board. Our concern is that the next DNA board, after our tenure has been completed, is simply faced with the same challenges, and they spend the next 5 years just trying to resolve, for the most part, the administrative burden that we've had to face as the first board. An MOU seeks to unpack where the roles are complementary in terms of what the DNA board does and the Civilian Secretariat for Police does, and where the DNA actually does, DNA board does provide expertise which the Civilian Secretariat cannot do. And in terms of that, the MOU does try and reach that, but we haven't got to a satisfactory solution in terms of what we believe is a resolution and what the CSP believe is a resolution. The difficulty is that because we are funded, the board is funded by the Civilian Secretariat, to a large extent we are constrained by by that fact that we can only do what we are allowed to do in terms of the fact that we are financed by the Civilian Secretariat for Police. Coupled with that is that although we make recommendations to the Minister of Police, we also don't have an enforceable mandate. So while saying we believe as experts that having considered the DNA Act and having considered the necessity, for instance, of the convicted offender index, that we recommend an amendment to take place at an extensive period. If that police minister at the time doesn't agree with our recommendation, there is nothing we can do to enforce our recommendation. So we don't have an enforceable mandate. Coupled with this is that we have difficulty, as I said, in terms of actually meeting and getting everybody together. And this really is a frustrating challenge. And it also undermines the work that is supposed to be carried out by the board. The reason that the people have been appointed to the board is because they bring specific expertise to the board. So if somebody from the DSC and DCS who can give us information in terms of what's happening in the convicted offender sampling program isn't there, then we lose the opportunity to discuss it at that board meeting. If somebody with a civil right or a human rights perspective isn't there to discuss what an ethical challenge is, we lose the opportunity. So going forward again, at the end of this presentation, I really do want you to listen to what the judge has to say in terms of the proposals that we've considered going forward that we think can work, because right now it's a flawed structure. The DNA board is a flawed structure, and it needs to be addressed, and it needs to be resolved, because it cannot carry on in the way it has been carrying on in the past. The strategic planning session, okay, I'm not going to go into that. I'm going to allow the judge to talk about that going forward. The regulations, as I said, currently they're with the state legal advisors. They've also gone backwards and forwards because everything that the board recommended in terms of putting together a regulation that gave impetus to the task team was actually undone by the state legal advisors, and everything we put in they took out. So again, as a board, we, with the necessary expertise, and with insight, we make recommendations, but then what happens, they get to another government department or another stakeholder, and then it's changed. So these are the frustrations that we are realizing, and hopefully going forward, we'll also keep your eye on the regulations in terms of, has this regulation been promulgated, and do these task teams have the necessary resources to carry out the work that they need to do. The procurement of buccal sample and evidence collection kits, again, we know that these have been now awarded. The next struggle is the maintenance kits. In order for the forensic science laboratories to continue to do the work that they do, they need the budget. And if their budget keeps getting eroded, previously they had access to the CJA, what is that, the cluster, yes, the integrated budget, which no longer has been, they no longer have access to that. So when the Act was actually promulgated, they were always under the impression that they had access to that in order to implement the Act in the way in which it was costed. With that budget continuously being derided and obviously made smaller and decreased, it just means that the work that they need to do in the forensic science laboratory, which does cost money, is challenged. So if you can't maintain the equipment, you obviously, the integrity of your results is compromised, because unless you are doing positive and negative controls within the forensic science laboratory, you are not able to actually submit that DNA profile in court, because the only way that you can show that the integrity of that result has gone through the correct quality management systems that are in place in the laboratory, you can't present that as evidence. So the controls are there because the maintenance contracts need to be in place. If you're not maintaining your equipment, your negative and positive controls aren't being put into place, and therefore you can't run a profile. It's not even worth paying the money to process a sample unless those maintenance contracts are in place. The same thing with the consumables. Whilst on the one hand saying I'm going to give you buccal samples and I'm going to give you sexual assault evidence and collection kits to the police, if you're not allowing the forensic science laboratory to purchase the consumables that actually are the chemistries that they need to analyze the samples, then all you're doing is you're having samples coming in and profiles not coming out. So when you do the gaps analysis and you say, let's say next year you go, okay, well we've received 100,000 samples, well that's great, but we've only got 10 profiles on the database. Well, that's because you don't have the chemistry and the resources to enable the forensic science laboratory to analyze that. So all of these things have to be looked at holistically, and you have to be able to resource all aspects of this process in order to ultimately give the forensic DNA database the power that it potentially has to resolve crime, specifically violent crime and sexual assault attacks, again, are often resolved through the DNA database. The convicted offender program, as you may be aware from the report, is a very simple amendment that was proposed, and it was twofold. The one was to say that not only must we extend the convicted offender program to ensure that this very important part of the National Forensic DNA database is in fact included, but also to ensure that any refusals that are taking place are addressed. So what they did was that they included in this amendment, we included in the amendment a provision to say that in the event that a convicted offender refuses, then they will be subject to further sentencing, they will be subject to a further offence. So what it did was that it gave them the alternative, if you don't submit your sample, then you potentially will be convicted of refusing because of the refusal in terms of the act. The amendment was actually presented to various ministers because the ministers of the police were different throughout the tenure of us trying to get this amendment through. The first minister that it was presented to wanted to get a costing in terms of how much would this cost. How much would it cost to sample convicted offenders? This had already been done at the time of processing the act, but in any event, that was considered to be fine once the various presentations had been made. The current police minister has not signed this amendment through, which we were hoping to have been done. I think it was in 2017 that it expired. Before 2017, the board had already flagged it to say we need to get forward with this, because the current police minister wants to put a population DNA database in place. A population DNA database is all civilians in the country, 52 million plus, must be included on this DNA database. I'll just remind you that we have two forensic DNA laboratories in this country. They already suffer from resource issues just to put our convicted offender or our suspect population on our DNA database. So from a financial and administrative position, the board does not recommend this to take place. We need to, at the very least, get our convicted offender population on our DNA database in order to ensure that the purpose of the DNA Act, which I referred to at the very beginning, is in fact adhered to, which is for criminal intelligence purposes. The very framework and the construct of the DNA database, the retention framework for privacy and human rights reasons, which was discussed at length during the run-up to the passing of the DNA Act, is that you cannot have innocent people on a DNA database from a civilian rights perspective. And this would then mean that the entire construct currently falls away, because all children who actually aren't even allowed to be on the database for more than 12 months, irrespective of why they're there, as well as all civilians, will then indefinitely be retained on a DNA database. Our suggestion has been that whilst the minister explores this with the Minister of Home Affairs, who has indicated that they would like to continue discussions on this basis, is that possibly a white paper gets drawn up with that in mind. But in the meantime, at the very least, if we can at the very least just sample the parolees before they leave, just the parolees, and make that a condition of their parole, which will also take away the refusals, but that is a very conservative and a very doable amendment that won't put strain on the costs, and it won't put strain in terms of the backlog that would be received at the forensic science laboratory. And from this perspective, even though it's not in this report, it is a meeting that we are trying to have with the minister, and perhaps it's a meeting that could take place all together with a portfolio committee, the DNA board, before our tenure is over, as well as the minister, to discuss this as a proposal. Because it is a very simple amendment that needs to be signed, and then we can continue with the convicted offender sampling program, which is a hugely important index within the forensic DNA database. And again, with the current gender-based violence that we're experiencing in this country, and the potential of actually linking a number of these people to either crimes they've committed or identifying them immediately if they commit a crime, it really is something that we can't negate. We have it within our grasp and we can't just simply let it go by not enforcing this going forward. In conclusion, the CODIS was the only thing that I wanted to say is that we haven't alluded to it here because at that time of this report, CODIS, which is a software solution that is going to run the DNA software in the DNA database, the good news is that recently the FBI did sign it with the banks, and they're just now looking at the implementation phase. This is an open source software that is available at no cost to the South African government. CODIS, they give it to administrations throughout the world. It's an excellent program, and we hope to see the implementation of that during the course of that year, of next year. Again, it's not in this reporting period, but just so that you know that it is something that has been overcome, and hopefully we'll be seeing the results of that. The benefit of having CODIS is that they can also do familial searching, and familial searching is allowed in unidentified and human remains on the DNA database. But you can only do that if you have this particular software. So we haven't been able to do familial searching because we haven't had this particular software. So that means that not only will that transitional arrangement in terms of the software solution, but also the familial searching will now come into place as a result of the software being implemented. I'm going to hand you over to the judge. Thank you very much for the conclusion.
Thank you so much, Vanessa. I know it took longer than envisaged, but it was necessary. The detail is absolutely necessary. What I'm going to do now is to just give you some information on the proposal that Ms. Lynch had alluded to with regard to finding what we think would be permanent, hopefully permanent, and much more effective solution to the challenges that we as a board had faced during the earlier stages of our establishment, which brought us to enter into a memorandum of understanding. Because we think the MOU will not be a permanent solution to deal with the tensions and the difficulties that we had experienced between the board and the CSPS. We have a much more substantial model of service delivery which we have in mind. And because we have not yet discussed it with the minister, we thought we could allude to it and just give the committee an idea of our thinking without depriving the minister of the first information. I think we should discuss our ideas with the minister before we discuss it with the committee. And hopefully the committee will give us an opportunity to present it, the idea, for the benefit of the new board, so that, as Ms. Lynch has indicated, they do not experience the challenges that we experience. Ms. Lynch had done, in her ordinary course of her work, some research into DNA legislation throughout the world. And she has observed that in many jurisdictions, Madam Chair, we have countries passing DNA legislation, and then they would appoint what is called a sunset structure, which deals with the setting systems in place in order to implement the new DNA legislation. And then that structure will just be temporary to put in place those systems, and then it will step back, and then particular bodies would then be appointed to take the implementation and the regulation of the legislation forward. Now, in terms of Section 15Z, of the DNA Act, the board has a mandate to make recommendations to the minister for amendments to the Act. And we thought, as a parting shot, we could make this proposal, which will require, unfortunately, unfortunately, or fortunately, or unfortunately, which would require substantial legislative amendment. It is drastic in the sense that it is substantial, but it has much utility in the sense that it may make the implementation of the Act effective. It would make the DNA Act effective as it is the objectives right now of the Act itself. Now, what we had thought was that we are given the opportunity to go back, and we will have until the end of January to make this proposal, and also ask that we be given an opportunity to present this proposal to the committee before we leave. And the idea is to have a model which brings the CSPS as the implementer of the Act, and which releases what may perhaps no longer be called the board from administrative burden, just as the MOU is doing, but the so-called board steps back, and then the CSPS becomes the implementing structure. The board would exist, continue to exist, or a panel of members of the board. Definitely it may not be the same members, new members, or some members drawn from this board, who have particular expertise, DNA expertise, to inform aspects of the implementation of the Act, who the CSPS can draw from. In other words, the board continues to exist through its members. The CSPS is the implementing body of the Act, and whenever it is necessary, we draw expert information from a panel which will be legislatively constructed in terms of the Act. And then the whole idea that there is continued tension between two bodies created by different legislation would seem to have similar mandates has always been a problem. There's a personal view, though, that the DNA board has been created for expertise, and the provision of expertise, knowledge, and information. And it is on that basis that it exercises oversight. Oversight and monitoring based on expert knowledge. The CSPS also has oversight and monitoring functions, however, from a civilian perspective. That is a debate, a continuing debate, but it is an area of much tension, and tensions create challenges, and the challenges almost cripple the implementation and the efficacy of the Act. So an implementing or service delivery, if you may call it, model that we would want to propose would do away with that and create the CSPS as an implementing body and the board as a panel or body of experts who can, whenever it is necessary, come in and provide expert knowledge and information. As I said, it would require substantial legislative amendment, and for that reason we would like to discuss it with the minister first before we present it in writing in a professional research-based document to the portfolio committee. Hopefully with the blessing of the minister, which I think should attract him to agree, because it, we believe that it is a permanent solution to the issues, and it would make the DNA Act effective, as the objective of our country. Thank you.
Thank you for the presentation. Thank you, Honorable Judge. I'll allow the civilian secretary to have the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I am appearing before the committee as a member of the court, and the chairperson of the board has spoken, and this is representing the board report. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Any other board members that would like to speak? The chair has spoken, so I think that gives us an opportunity to hear it. Honorable Judge?
I was saying we're waiting for an opportunity to respond to questions and engagement from the portfolio committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Judge. Honorable members, I've noted the hands of Honorable Whitfield, Molekwa, and then Ter Blanche. Is that ordered?
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you very much for the presentation. I think, without a doubt, it's the most detailed presentation I think this committee has received, certainly in a very long time, if ever in the City Party. And Chairperson, you know that the committee, I think, is passionate about this issue as it relates to DNA and the amendment bill in particular, as well as the issue of rape kits, which the committee has been very outspoken on in the past. So thank you very much for educating the committee as well, because it's a highly complex subject. I don't believe that we are the experts in DNA, and so it is wonderful to have those experts here today. I just want to stress, Chairperson, at the outset that there are two issues we need to confront and repeat until they are corrected. Neither of them affect the board directly, but absolutely affect the committee. The one is the absence of the deputy minister who you mentioned would be on his way. The presentation has been concluded. The deputy minister was not here. Secondly, the minister is not here. We have raised this issue last week. Quite strongly, Chairperson, I understand, you know, that you were obviously not available for that meeting, but I'm sure that you have had feedback that it was raised very strongly that the absence of the Minister and the Deputy Minister, in fact, the Deputy Minister has attended more committee meetings than the Minister. I think the Minister's presented the crime statistics and one or two other meetings. It fundamentally undermines our responsibility to hold the executive to account. And we almost sit in a stalemate situation where we are presented with very frank and honest information, which we need to interrogate the minister on as well, because I don't believe that he has treated some of these issues with the urgency that they deserve. He was not appointed to the parliament, he was a minister in the parliament as well. And so we also need to just please have that on the record and make sure that the minister and the deputy minister understand that they account to this committee as well. And if we are to enable the board and this civilian secretariat and various other structures to do their jobs properly, we need to be able to hold them accountable. The second issue is related, and that is that last week we had the DPCI judge, which reports to the civilian secretariat, and now we've got the DNA board, which reports to the civilian secretariat or to the minister, but through the civilian secretariat. In both meetings, the issue of confusion around mandate, reporting lines, authority has occurred. And so, again, the absence of the minister and deputy minister to provide clarity as to what they are going to do to clear that up it is critically important. And I hasten to say that they obviously do not see this as serious as we as seriously as we do, because last week was one of the most dysfunctional meetings I've ever experienced. I mean, we had the Secretary of Police and the judge effectively having a back and forth on issues that should have been dealt with previously, or certainly behind closed doors by the minister. So having said that, Chairperson, I've got quite a lot of input, and I hope that you'll bear with me, because it is such an important subject, and I don't want anyone to leave, or certainly for myself to leave feeling confused or having left anything off the table. The judge has sort of left us in a little bit of suspense as to the details around the proposal. I don't want to say the judge was making a political statement, but obviously being very careful about undermining the important authority of the minister and giving him the first bite at the details. Perhaps if he was here, we could have made it more difficult for the judge and said, well, the minister's here and the committee's here, we should have dealt with it all together. But I appreciate that there are protocols, but I think we need some clarity, and as far as you can possibly go, is you said what may no longer be the court, but the so-called board, and the board steps back, but a panel of members would continue to exist. Now, one of the concerns that I would have is the robust nature of the annual report and the presentation. How are we going to safeguard that? And I say that because your board constitutes civilians in the truest sense of the word. Right? So you have civilian experts who, while the board reports to the minister, do not necessarily owe the minister the same allegiance as a civil servant that may come and report to the committee. So if there's a panel that now replaces the board, who reports to the committee? And if it's the civilian secretariat, who appoints the secretary of the police? I just need to understand, in terms of accountability, this is critically important, because there are some, in fact, let's reference one of the lines from the presentation. There was some relatively strong language, although I probably could use stronger language, but like crippling challenges, for example, it helps us to understand the seriousness of the issues at hand, and that the board is not in support, this is on page 5 of the presentation, the board is not in support of the proposed establishment of the national DNA database due to reasons raised in parliament. So they disagree clearly with the minister's decision. That helps the committee to understand that there are differing views. Now, if the minister monopolizes the chain of accountability, I would be concerned as to what kind of information the committee would get. It would like some guarantees, I think, as to how we would continue to receive that transparency and accountability. Perhaps it was answered, but I am going to just ask the question, why the MOU has not been finalized? What the specific reasons are? Does it rest with the minister? Are there still issues related to details around the MOU? And obviously, judge, your proposal, should it carry favour with the minister, then would do away with the necessity for an MOU. But we can't plan for that eventuality. We need, this is what is in front of us. There's a draft MOU. Do you believe that the draft MOU, once there is consensus, will enable a more effective working relationship? And then that would possibly negate the necessity for the amendments that you would propose to the minister. And will the relationship improve? Because I understand it's not necessarily, unlike last week, a clash of personalities, but rather a clash of protocol and systems and who reports to who and who is who in the zoo. I'd also like to know, and thank you for raising the issue of CODIS, what progress has been made with regard to the implementation? So an agreement was signed. Has there been any progress with respect to that agreement? One of the concerning consistencies in the reporting was, we're coming to the end of our term as a board. The term is ending. We keep hearing the term is ending. And there are issues hanging in the air. Chairperson, we're a new committee, and I think we've been very outspoken on the amendment bill, if I can call it the DNA amendment bill, or the forensic procedures amendment bill. Yet that matter, I think, is probably one of the great legacies of the board, which is not that process has not been completed, and this committee now needs to decide how we go about dealing with it. But with respect to the end of the board's tenure, what plans and processes have been in place to appoint a new board? What is the process that needs to be followed? And I specifically would like to know who is responsible for ensuring that there is a smooth transition from the outgoing board to a new board. Because this committee is going to convene next year, we're going to consider annual reports. Who is going to present? Is a board going to be in place? Is there going to be a seamless transition? I think those are some questions that we need to be clear on so that we can understand what to expect next year. The bill itself, Chair, I've said it before, is anathema to me that the Minister cannot sign that and send it to Parliament. And it is anathema because there is no reason, as dystopian in nature as it is, for the Minister to want to pursue a national DNA database, which the presentation and my own gut tells me, as someone who is not a legal expert, will never pass constitutional muster. There's nothing preventing the Minister from investigating that, but sending the amendment bill to Parliament. And I would say, Chairperson, the Minister is acting extremely irresponsible to suspend the referral of this bill to Parliament while investigating, which are actually two separate issues. Fundamentally irresponsible. That then leads to the question, which is, and I'm delighted to see that there is a member on the board from the Correctional Services. Is that right? Yeah. So whether the board has received feedback as to the number of Schedule 8 offenders that have been released on parole without having had their DNA. What is that number? The Civilian Secretariat came to the committee some months ago, and I think it was Ms. Bell who presented that there were 46,727 Schedule 8 offenders whose DNA had not been tested. I'm interested in whether that number is the same, whether it's increased possibly, and whether there is information available to this committee on those that have actually been released on parole. That there are people roaming the streets who were convicted, who are out on parole, who we do not have DNA samples for. Because the chain of accountability in gender-based violence cannot be, every police station now has a rape kit, evidence collection kit, fantastic, right? That is treating the, not necessarily treating the symptom, which is much more complex. If we are able to create an impermeable system of accountability within the justice system, where people know that their DNA will be taken, where they know that if they are a repeat offender, that it's going to catch up with them. If people understand that our justice system is able, as in the case that the deputy chairperson gave us, where someone was convicted of assault and they were linked to over 30 rapes, that is a huge deterrent. Well, perhaps I should ask the question to the judge, but the judge believed that that would be a significant deterrent not just repeat offenders, but for those who are aware that these are the kind of sentences that can be imposed. Can I continue, Chair? Sorry.
Honourable Whitfield, you are not interrupted. You have done a lot of work.
Thank you. Thank you. We've been waiting a long time for this meeting, Chair.
I know.
Thank you.
I owe you today.
You own me or owe me?
Oh,
okay.
Please.
All right. Chair, the issue of rape kits has been perhaps misunderstood, perhaps even by myself, as to, you know, the technicalities of it. You know. But the bottom line is not every police station has one. The bottom line is that these evidence collection kits need to be transported from either neighbouring police stations or wherever they exist in order for rape victims to have evidence collected, to be transported to hospital, their evidence collected. But who is responsible directly for the procurement of forensic services laboratory, and what role does the board play in terms of that? And perhaps the more difficult question is, to what extent does the DNA board, in their oversight of that process, if that is a function of the board, believe that the emergency procedures that were referred to in the presentation were above board in terms of all applicable legislation? Because when I see emergency, and I'll start to worry about circumvention of supply chain, what are the potential implications of rushing something like this? The spokesperson for the National Police Commissioner on this topic had said that that provinces were instructed to go out on quotation to get rapids for the provinces. That may not be something that you can deal with or answer, but it calls into question who the suppliers were for all of those quotations. They went out on quotations. And this was prior, in fact this was from January this year, that was prior to the awarding of a tender in August this year. So there was the tender was awarded in August. Do we know who the service provider is? Can we please understand who that company is? And can the committee's mind be put at rest with respect to the process that was followed in the procurement of the rape kits, which are still finding their way to these commissions? And perhaps I didn't read the report 100%, but my ideal outcome here would be for the board to become more effective rather than to try and create a back channel route and how we can go about doing that. So are board members remunerated for attendance at meetings? The only board member that was removed for non-attendance was Ms. Monama, if I'm not mistaken. Are there other board members who have missed, I didn't see an attendance sort of schedule in the, but a summary of the number of meetings each board member has taken. Is that the only one? Are there other concerns? Are there repeat offenders with respect to non-attendance at the meetings? I don't want to ask all the questions, Chair, but I'm almost there. I want to know with regards to the maintenance of equipment, and this is quite important. This is the beginning and end of everything in the criminal justice system. Right? So DNA is so important. If the maintenance of equipment, it's been flagged as a risk, right? So the budget is declining year on year. The constraints it places on the laboratories, maintenance of equipment. To what extent does the board provide oversight on the procurement of equipment and the contracting of maintenance for that equipment? And has there been a situation where, due to a lack of funding or procurement negligence, where a sample has been corrupted as a result of equipment non-maintenance? And then the position of the deputy director, I wasn't sure if you'd said that position has now been filled. What is the remuneration of that position? So what is that, if that detail is available? Because compensation of employees, I think, was an issue in the expenditure of reports perspective in terms of compensation of employees, what that might be. And given that there are no complaints, that's the last question. It's the last question for now, Chair. That given no complaints have been submitted, perhaps I'm not understanding the function of the deputy director. What would be the purpose for appointing somebody in that role? What would they be investigating? Are we just filling a position on the organogram for the sake of filling it and paying somebody? Because efficiency and the functioning of the board must also apply to how we use our money wisely, not just necessarily the outcomes that are achieved. Chairperson, that's all for now. Thank you very much for your touches.
Thank you, Honourable Whitworth. Honourable Mulekwa.
Thank you, Chairperson.
from which this is covered by honourable member here, but Chairperson, I just want to emphasize on the presentation. But quickly acknowledge the presentation as you presented to us. The challenge I see on the presentation is that the presentation is more of the challenges than the solutions. Because if you look into the presentation, it dwells much on the tensions amongst the two entities. So I was expecting that at the end, there would be maybe the recommendations from your side, or that recommendation should put at least temporary measures on the solution, on the challenges that are presented in the presentation, whereas the portfolio committee has been weak on the permanent solution on the issue. Again, Chairperson, I'm more also worried that the tensions also contribute towards the service delivery. Hence, the presentation also indicates that there is a shortage of rape kits, so which means the perpetrators are not going to be tested, and what will be the result as a when the victims acknowledge or have an information that the department has a shortage of kids. So it's a danger to the society because this poses a very serious challenge. As a government, we are committed in fighting the gender-based violence. Now, if we are having these challenges, it gives more challenges also to the government because there is serious backlog of cases. As you know that recently, we have experienced more cases on gender-based violence, and rape are one of those cases. So if we are still having these challenges, which means the challenge of the cases will not be easily be completed. And I just want to also know who is responsible for procurement, and then why the delay? Because that delay causes more problems between the entities. The other issue I want to raise, Chairperson, is on the issue of public engagement. Because I see here the statement saying, due to the fact that the board is currently unknown to the general public, which means the public doesn't know the board, and they don't know where to raise their issues or to take their concerns. So I just want to find out that is there any program in place for public engagement? And if so, what were the outputs out of the engagement that you had with the general public? Because this statement is also problematic. If you are a board member or not engaging to the community, because it's your responsibility to make sure that you engage so that you assess the government in terms of key government issues.
Thank you very much, Honorable Sabla. Honorable Majority and Honorable Wok, I know I asked you to continue in one of our meetings, which we jointly attended, Raka. Thank you very much, Honorable Sabla.
Chairperson, thank you. Chairperson, let me start by really commending Judge Foro and the presenter. I think it was excellent done. I'm still not an expert chair yet, but I've learned quite a bit, and thank you very much for that. Chairperson, I want to start where I ended, and I raised my serious concerns about the fact that the Deputy Minister or the Minister wouldn't. I expected this, Chairperson. You know, I want to come a little bit stronger on that. It is quite obvious, Chairperson, that they are, if I can term it this, remember English is not my first language, but I think they are running away from their responsibility. They don't want to face difficult questions. And Chairperson, we cannot allow that such an important issue
that this committee is undermined because people are playing hide and seek with us. And I'm going to leave it at that. Really, this is the last meeting, Chairperson. In future, if it happens again, then we will have to decide as a committee whether we are going ahead with that meeting or not. Maybe we should be postponing meetings in the future if people like the ministers are not here. I'm leaving at that. Chairperson, the presenter told us that this is a fraud structure, if I'm my bad. Fraud, yeah. Sorry, I. Sorry, I. That is a wrong slip of the tongue. Fraud. It's a flawed structure, and really, I agree with that. Then, obviously, not necessarily something of their making. I touched on the minister already. Chairperson, and then our old enemy again. Supply chain management issues. This committee, or this board rather, is incapacitated, or the system then is incapacitated because of not having the correct, you know, testing kits and whatever that they should be having. Then also we heard about, you know, possible amendments of legislation, and I can just, you know, think myself about quite a few that will have to be revisited and amended. And I think the judge will agree with me that we have opportunities, you know, where we can ensure in future that these tests, if I can call it that, will be done. You know, if I think, you know, let's say with the sentencing of a person, you know, that can be a prerequisite there that it must be done. Then obviously we can ensure that it's going to be done. So maybe we need to be very inventive and really scrutinize legislation properly to ensure that we will be, you know, arrive at a point where we are going to deal with that. My learned friend here next to me really, you know, Chairperson, he made my job very easy. He touched on the maintenance contracts and stuff like that. You know, really, if the tools are not in a working order, then we can just as well stop the whole process. So that is not negotiable, Chairperson. We will really have to come strongly out regarding that as well, ensuring that the equipment that they use will be functional. Chairperson, then we did touch on the MOU. Can it really be that difficult? I leave it at that, Chairperson. Really, I think that is something that we need to pursue and try to get that in place also as a matter of urgency. Chairperson, then lastly, the procurement of the kits. You know, to really have a two-year, you know, process. I spent 30 years of my life in a procurement environment, and, you know, it can't be that difficult. You know, just to get a contract in place. Chairperson, thanks. My colleague covered me otherwise, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mahan.
Thank you very much, Chair, and the judge, and all stakeholders and fellow members. Listening to the presentation, which was quite different and quite informative and technical in its aspect, and very complex, it was like listening to a horror movie. You know, I don't want to be technical about this aspect of the report. Is that we are sitting with 20,000 people dying in a country in a year. And by sitting here and listening, that we are becoming complicit to this crime as well. Because taking into account in the previous report from the DPCI, as well as the CSPS, I feel I'm sitting in the same situation again, where there are issues that needed to be addressed. Having taken into account that I looked at the previous report, the DPCI is that in the previous administration, that is the fifth parliament, the same concerns were raised, and we are still sitting with the same concerns that we are repeating what has been already on the table and has even been discussed by the previous, in the fifth administration. When I sit here, I question myself as to whether are we not doing the same thing again, where there has been presentation, perhaps some of us were not there, actually as a fact we were not there, but are we not repeating what has been there before? Because now you are reaching your end of term by almost next month, probably between 2 months time. That it means we have been sitting with a problem for quite a while. And nothing much has been done about it, including having to deal with an MOU becomes a hassle or a difficulty in that aspect. So my problem is, you know, we can sit and listen to all that you are saying. And there's no one who provides solutions to problems that you have been sitting with for quite a while. And the question that I must ask my fellow members here in the committee, are we going to be complicit to the same thing? Because there's nothing much that you get out of the whole thing of sitting here and talking all these horrendous things that we see here, that you are not getting help, you are not being supported, and there's the absence of the minister. There should be a recourse. There must be a decision taken to say, if we are confronted with such situations, what do we do as the committee? But we are going to sit in, year out, listen to all the presentations, whereas we are a problem ourselves because we don't bring in solutions. There's also the issue of maladministration and corruption that has been said as well. What has been done about it? Because it has been actually highlighted that there is corruption and maladministration in terms of procurement and all those sorts of things there. But nothing happens again. So are we also endorsing or rubber stamping the very corruption that has been said and maladministration as well? So I get confused all the time by coming here listening to the stories that have got no ending or no solution. Now, on the issue of the rape kits and all that, we also know that there's no such a story that the rape kits are all in all the stations. That we know is a fact. And we are told we have procured and then we are providing all police stations. All police stations are provided for rape kits. And then the story that we get is that that's not true. And nobody accounts for such lies. Now, the issue is that we need to come up with solutions ourselves. And because there is transgression in terms of the act itself, and we do nothing about it. Nobody says, let's take it up. Let's engage for those who transgress the act and then see what happens next. So, I really feel despondent about all these things that are happening, and I'm not happy about it. And I don't want to be taken as if we begin to probe into things that are said and written here because I believe them anyway. And there should be something, including the deployments of people. So I do not know, but the question that we all have to answer as ourselves as the committee members is that what do we do to help the system itself to come into fruition and so that we have a result? The concern I have is that there are people dying every day. There are people who are getting scot-free. The police are doing good work. There is no evidence to help such investigations. A criminal goes scot-free. But out there, the communities do not know the complexities of the investigations because they are not experts. The family wants to see a member being arrested because the person knows this one raped my child, this one raped my woman. But the thing is, there is no evidence to that because the police or the investigators have compromised, including this body has compromised such things as those kids and all those sorts of things that are actually technical about that. As my former the investigators also said, that we are not experts in that field, but the rest we are not happy. That things are not going in the month they should. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Majeri. Honourable Shimbini, do you have a question? Honourable Majeri.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think we must acknowledge that we do have a problem in the Department of Police because I don't want to blame you alone, but I would expect that the entities will then complement each other. Because what my fellow colleagues are saying is true. There are no kids in all police stations. For that matter, this report should speak to me in a way that there is no police station here. That is why we cannot provide such and such, and there are police stations there. Because we know of places where there are no police stations. Like in Tepisong, people have to go to Kagiso or Slov. That is about 120 kilometers away from where they are. But now, people in that area, you can imagine how many people get raped every day and they cannot get help. So I would think that in all the entities, we need entities that will complement each other because we are in the same department at the end of the day. Because the perpetrators, they walk away free and the victims are left with scars that cannot be solved. And how do you go around, how do you walk around in the same neighborhood where you were raped by the same person that you are going to see each and every day? That is torture on its own. So I don't know, Chairperson, as a committee, what is it that we can do, but if it's possible that, and you also find that the police in other stations, because they know that is not their truth restriction where they should go, where they should go, they will then have that attitude that is not part and parcel of our area, so we cannot come there. So you are left with yourself and to deal with the rape that you went through. So I'm not sure, Chair, because I would have expected in the conclusion that maybe we'll find a solution that would say then as entities we must then find a way of complementing each other because we are in the same department. At some point in time, I'm sure you do have your general meetings where you sit and you look at such things. While the rape kits are still on their way to the police station, what is happening to the people there in those areas? You can imagine those victims, what is it that they go through? So I'm not sure, Chairperson, maybe this is one proposal I would make if it's seconded, is that we need to have a general, whether it's a workshop or what, with all entities in the police department. So that then we are able to say, you are not doing your job, you are not doing your job, this is what should have been done, this is what you should be doing. Because right now we are going to blame you, we are going to blame the other entity when it comes and reports, but we are not getting the end of the story. So I would propose that we have a general meeting, whether it's a two-day meeting or a workshop, where then we get to the gist of I don't want to put a blame on anyone. Maybe we have procured all the red kit, but maybe the service provider has not provided the kit. And what do you go around and obviously, yes, you must take a blame because you come here and you report to us. But at the end of the day, we must complement each other, all these entities. So that is what I would propose, Chairperson, for now. I'm just thinking of the victims. What is it that they go through every day? So I don't even want to go further. I want us to get solutions to the problem that we have at the current moment. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Majosi, Honorable Shabeni, and then Mapato.
Thank you, Chairperson. I don't have much notice to decide. The thing is, we cannot sit here the whole day thinking, talking about only two things. The thing is, we must get the kids. That's it. And it has been long, it has not started this year. I think it's some 4 to 5 years back that the kids started disappearing. When you go to the stations, there are no kids and all these things. Now, it's about getting those kids, because we started this thing. We said we must have samples taken from the offenders. And then we cannot leave it along the way. No. That means, I don't know, we're incompetent, all of us. I'm sorry to say that, but that's the truth. Because a lot is happening. We are paying for leasing of buildings and all these things. But here we are failing to do the most important thing. Our kids, our mothers and sisters are being raped, killed, and all these things are happening. We must have those kids. They are very important. So the thing is, do we have a company? If there's a company now that has been approved or just been awarded a tender, it's up to the board to check, is that company the right company for what, and let this thing go on. Let the government take the responsibility. We've got people. We cannot sit here talk. It's not going to help us. Somebody who's responsible must do his or her work. We must all do ours. Take responsibility for everything that we're given to do. That's how it must work. We cannot sit here and say, blah, blah, blah. It's about getting those kids or getting the company. Because I've noticed here there are companies, here it was said now in the 19th, or on the 19th of the ninth month, I've got different dates here. In June, in February, and in July. 2018, 2017, tenders were advertised and nothing happened. Another one, the tender here was advertised in February 2018 with the closing date of 16 February. That one also, it was stopped or cancelled because of an investigation. The other one here also was cancelled because they did not receive the responsible bids or whatsoever. Now, the thing is, tenders are being cancelled here. I don't know what is the problem. And if a bidder is being investigated, and then we cannot let the country down because of one bidder. How many people were there? How many companies were there? So something is wrong, as one of my colleagues have said. This goes with corruption. Because if not, we get the right bidder, we award the right bidder with the contract, and then it's done. Thank you, Chairperson. Oh, lastly, sorry, Chair. Lastly, I think the issue of the training of the police officials. I don't know that, is that not being done once police officers are in the college. The training of the police officers, are they not getting the training
of taking the buccal samples while they are in the training college, because that's the easier. There are there more than 7,000 police officials. So it's easy, and you don't even spend. They are there. Thank you very much.
Honorable Deputy Minister, welcome. We appreciate your availability. There has been a concern that we really wish to know that we needed to be here. So thank you very much for arriving. Honorable members, we have put this item on the agenda as a standalone item, since it has a high level of importance to us, especially with regard to gender-based violence. So we are not going to rush you. We are going to give you sufficient time to respond. We still have two more outstanding questions. Honorable Mapatu and then Majority.
Thank you, Chair. So I arrived late, but the report, Chair, is not different to, it's a little bit different from the last week report. Because the last week report, it was more of a complaint. And about the DPCI stroke judge, right? And the civilian secretariat, which we said, let's refer back the report, and then maybe the minister should be present in this meeting. But this one is a little bit in a polite way, making a very polite way, that there are problems. And I don't want us to delay you, Chair, because most of the members here have alluded to that. You know, yesterday we made a statement and we get the report today, which is contrary to what we said yesterday. Now, if there's a problem with the procurement, so how do you meet your target? If the supply chain it's a problem. You're not going to be able to meet your targets. You make statements forever. So the problem has been identified. The supply chain. And I agree with honorable members. If there is an investigation, it's not for a supply chain to stop the process. There's a capacity to investigate. If the police is there, it's residing with them, to investigate, but it cannot stop the process of procuring what is needed most in the police stations. Now you say that now the we are still investigating. The memorandum of understanding. The board is saying it's still experiencing challenges in relation to its independence, which impacted on its ability to clearly articulate and execute its mandate. But they've said they want to present to the minister the proposal of how this two entities can be able to operate independently, or not independently, but more or less in a smooth way, you know, that there must be a smooth relationship. Now, Chair, a significant decline in the number of cases registered and finalized can be linked to the shortage of evidence collection kits and consumables. It's in the report here. So that means the report that we receive sometimes as the committee here, it's not a full reflection of what is happening in the department. And this is a specialized department, this one, of the DNA. We deal with special people with special skills. It's not like a general practitioner. Even the doctors, they are general practitioners, will refer you to the specialists who specialize. And specialists are very few to get them. So I would say, Chair, although the DM is here, maybe we should wait for his response to what has been presented here. But I think maybe we need to do the same like we did with the DPCI slow charge. That maybe they should go back and meet with the minister, and in the presence of the minister and the DM is here representing the ministers. It's not representing the ministers here. There's a deputy minister. So the deputy minister can respond on behalf of the department. Yeah, the deputy minister. So I'm not sure, sir, after his response, we can take a decision. But my proposal would be, we can't, as a committee, continue sitting, getting presentations that should have been resolved before they come here. Because if people, they come to the portfolio committee and raise such issues that are here in the document, that means they're crying for help. To say, the portfolio, please help us. There are these challenges. So I was proposing that maybe after the response of the deputy minister, we might take a particular decision. It's important that we do our work from oversight without fear or favor, so that the department must be able to work efficiently. So it's important that that's my proposal, that there are things that meet the minister in this presentation. So maybe they should go back and be resolved before they come back again here and present to us. Because here is a cry for help. It's a cry for help that there are things that the DNA cannot move. And the reports that we are receiving here is that some of the, if I'm correct, I was late, but I hear that some of the criminals might have been released without lack of evidence, because there is this shortage of some of the, if I'm correct, shortage of some of this forensic kits. So we might be releasing people who are serious threat to the society because of lack of this forensic testing kit. I'm saying this is a very specialized committee or a board, and that needs to assist the police, you know. And if they don't get support, and now their term is coming to an end, we are new. One member just said here, we are new. They might go. Hence, we have been asking for what you call them, the justice reports, the handing and taking of what you call them.
Handover reports.
That we must familiarize ourselves with what happened last, with the last report that you presented. What did the committee do? It might not be the first report that we are referring to, but we are receiving here. Because it's important to get those things. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable members, I had an equally long list of questions, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to get the minister here. Dame, I'm not putting you on the spot, but there were certain questions which the honorable members wanted to raise with the ministry. I'll just give you 1 minute, and I mean strictly 1 minute, to just look into specifically those questions you raised for the minister or the deputy minister when we did not have either the minister or the deputy minister in the meeting. So I'll start with Whitfield. I'll go again according to the list, Whitfield, and then Molekwa, Sir Blanche, Mafanya. That is how we, the order of the meeting, Shemdeni, Majozi, and then Mapatso, the team was here, and Majozi, the team were here, when you were speaking. Whitfield?
Thank you very much.
That is if you would like to do so.
No, I wouldn't. I respectfully decline, and I say with the greatest respect, I am not going to waste my time repeating questions that I asked the board, where the deputy minister or the minister should have been here from the outset of the meeting. Now, I understand that the deputy minister is a very busy person. I appreciate that. But this committee has been repeatedly disrespected by the executive. Repeatedly. That is the issue that we had yesterday. Nobody was disagreeing with that at the outset. Nobody said it was, you know, not a problem that they haven't been present. But we had an entire presentation. We had a host of questions. And I respectfully decline to repeat those questions when the Deputy Minister has not had the opportunity to engage in the presentation from the board, which wasn't a verbatim report. There were details confused into the report. There was information supplied. There was context provided. It's just too complex. Thank you.
Honourable Dean.
Thanks, Chair. I don't think members must repeat themselves. They've asked questions, and the team is here. They'll respond to the questions. And those that need my comment, I will. Why I don't think we must restart it. It's not appropriate.
Just to clarify, I did not expect members to repeat all the questions, but there were specific questions which I thought the board might be able to respond. Let us give the board the opportunity to respond, and then we'll take those questions
which I do know the board is not fair at this point. Thank you very much. Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. What we will do, we will respond to groups of questions in terms of the subjects. And in that we will deal with questions. Sometimes honourable members ask similar questions, questions which deal with similar issues. So members of the board will respond to subject questions or questions in terms of subjects, and hopefully respond to specific questions asked by the honourable members. If there is any need for any more specificity, then we will deal with that. We hope to deal with all the questions. Thank you. Honourable Whitfield, you raised a very important concern regarding the robustness that we expect the board to have, and so that when we come up with a proposal that we envisage, the question is, and you asked it, will we be able to preserve that level of robustness in new so-called proposed structure? It is as if you were there. Only this morning we had a meeting among the board members, and I raised exactly that issue. It is important that whatever proposals we come up with, this new structure, we have a body, whatever we will call it, that is sufficiently robust so that it is capacitated to exercise oversight and the monitoring that is required in terms of the act. So that is important. You question the details of the proposed, what we now call service delivery model that we will come up with. And indeed, I sounded as if we have the detail, we're just reserving it for the minister. Mm-hmm. As I preceded my discussion, I said, Ms. Lynch, in the work that she does with her teaching around DNA issues and the NGO work that she does, she did research and came up with this information. And we thought, she actually proposed that we look into whether or not we can follow what other countries are doing, other jurisdictions are doing. We have not gone into the details. We have discussed the possibility. The board will have to continue while this new body has not been effectively adopted. So there is no possibility that we will ever be boardless. Cannot be boardless. There might be a transition, and if by the time this board ends its term and the new proposals have not been adopted, we will have to continue as normal in terms of the act and appoint a new board. Oh, there's also a possibility that our term might be extended so that we replace this particular board with a new or newly proposed structure. We don't have a structure yet. We are engaging with each other, and for the remaining time between now and the end of our term, and as I said, there's a possibility that our term, we could ask that our term be extended just so that we do this work and come up with an alternative proposal. The possibility is that you might reject it, or it
made the agenda. The important matter to us is that the independence, the robustness must be preserved. That monitoring and oversight function must remain as strong as it possibly can. In fact, if we can come up with a model that even strengthens it, considering the difficulties that we have experienced during our term, I think that will inform greatly what we hope to come up with. So it is not that I'm holding back information. We don't have as yet sufficient information to give so that we rest assured that we will have this kind of good. We are engaging in the nature of the body, and we will certainly come back to you in that regard. I hope that satisfies you for now. And then you asked the other important question, whether sampling will be a significant deterrent. You know what? I'm not a criminologist, and I don't claim to be one. But sometimes I wonder what goes on in the mind of an offender, particularly repeating offender, who offends despite the fact that some stringent punishment has been meted out to other people who came before her or him who have similarly offended. I don't even have to go into the death penalty issues. But I think it will go some way. I think it will go some way because for me, at a personal level, getting arrested is probably the first step towards dealing effectively with punishing offenders. If I know that I will be arrested, my view is that that can act as a deterrent. And the question of sampling is about arresting offenders, identifying offenders, following them up, arresting them. And to answer your question, personally, I think it can be a very effective deterrent. And if we can be assisted with the procurement of sampling kits, I think we'll go a long way in resolving the very concerns that almost each and every honorable member who had an opportunity to ask questions referred to. Sexual offenses, violence against women, repeated violence against women, undeterred violence against women. I think we need to do something about that. So to answer you, yes, I think it will be significant deterrent if we can just get those kids. Continuous our sampling in all the areas that we have been falling short of. It is necessary. I think the procurement issue is really important because there seems to be a perception that we are responsible for procurement and for contracts, maintenance contracts. I think Vanessa Lynch will deal effectively with that. Just to put the record straight and assure members that if we were directly responsible for procurement, we are so concerned that we would have done something.
Thank you very much. I'm going to go through some of the questions that the judge has asked me to answer in terms of my presentation. The first was the CODIS. I whilst after you asked the question, I asked somebody in the FSL what the progress is. The state legal advisors made a number of changes to the contract that was sent to the FBI, and the FBI haven't accepted the contract with the changes. So the contract has now gone back to SLA with a view to not resolving it. Until such time as the two entities agree, that won't be signed. So that's the only progress I have in respect of COVID, unfortunately. Again, as the judge mentioned, as a board, we can only identify the areas where there are issues, make recommendations. So for instance, with CODIS, what we did is that we got the SLA to come before us and say, why haven't you signed the contract? They then signed the contract, but they made the changes. So the next step will be for us to say, why do you want to make these changes? Can we now help you to resolve it? Because the FBI are obviously not going to move in terms of that particular contract. So that's the only progress. Just to rest assured you, there is a software solution in place currently. It's not that it doesn't work, it does work. It's just not as advanced. It's a software solution provided by CODIS, and it doesn't allow for familial searching. So it's just going to be a step up in terms of what we've got. But currently they can still do searches, and they can still enter all the profiles onto that particular database. So it's not as if we don't have a system in place. If we were going from a position where we had no system, then it would be much more urgent. But obviously it's just going to be a much more efficient system. Secondly, in terms of the outgoing committee, until such time as a transition has been arranged, the new committee will be appointed, and the next tenure is 3 years, and some of the existing committee members can reapply should they wish to. May I just say, though, that the portfolio committee also vets those people if they can, because understanding that the Minister of Police is actually responsible for appointing those members. And it's actually very important that the civilian sector is represented, and to have people that are outspoken like myself and are able to say from a civilian perspective, I think it is important with a new incoming committee that you do have representation like that, and that you do have people who have the necessary expertise as well as the passion to, just as you say, to ensure that ultimately the people that are going to benefit from this are survivors or hopefully people that actually aren't even going to have crimes committed against them because we have an effective solution. So please be mindful when you will meet the new committee members, board members, just as we did, if that's the way it's going forward, that you're also mindful of who is being represented on that board, and that they have the necessary expertise, passion and skills to do so from each of those sectors. Secondly, the Department of Correctional Services, Mark's going to answer that at the end of this. I think we were sent a spreadsheet that might have given us the numbers that unfortunately the representative is not here today, that will give us the number of Schedule 8 offenders who have been released without having been sampled. In terms of the rape kits as well as the buffer sample kits, the company's name is called Racina. I actually was at a conference last week where I met a representative from Racina, and they said that they were delivering 300,000 kits in December. That's what they said. The difficulty with this, as I explained previously, is that the DNA board cannot get too involved in operational structures. We are a part-time board. We identify the issues, such as why are samples not being received? Oh, it is because they have no kits. So what we did is that we brought in somebody from supply and chain management. They said to us at a board meeting, we only have X amount left. They couldn't do anything further until the bid adjudication committee awarded the contract. We've got the bid adjudication committee in front of us, and we said, why are you not awarding this contract? Do you understand that it is a very specific supplier because of contamination issues, you're dealing with DNA, and because the kits, the sample kits have to conform to being able to be used in the machines that are in the forensic science laboratory. So it's not a plug and play. You can't get an off-the-shelf product. They actually have to create, they have to manufacture it to fit into the machines or the equipment in the forensic science laboratory. Just as an example, the person on the bid adjudication committee, they were not able to award it because of Scopa investigating it. The next time we met, that very person was actually before Scopa for corruption. Now, this is just an example of how involved we try to get, but also how many challenges we faced along the way. So we're very aware of what is going on, but there's only so much we can do at every step, at every meeting, in terms of making recommendations. So the fact that this now has been awarded is actually a very positive step forward. Acina is the supplier, and they have been cleared by the bid adjudication committee as well as SCOPA. And obviously, because they've only just been awarded the contract, there is going to be a slight lag in terms of delivery. And certainly if you as a portfolio committee get supply chain management in, as well as any other stakeholders such as the forensic science laboratory, to say, okay, are you receiving samples, or are you receiving those kits, and how much have been delivered? So that's maybe from the portfolio committee, is that when you have those meetings to actually ask them their statistics. In terms of the maintenance contracts, those again, when you have the South African Police Services or you have the Forensic Science Services in front of you, that's also a question that you could be asking them. Do they need to scope their budget higher? Why haven't they been given the budget in order for them to order those maintenance and supply kits? Bear in mind that a machine or one of those analysis machines will not run a sample unless they have those controls in place, and those controls can only be in place if that maintenance has been done on that particular piece of equipment. So the quality management systems in place are adhered to very, very strictly in those laboratories. And as such, there won't be any areas of concern. A profile won't come out corrupted, so to speak, because it will never be put into that machine in the first place. So if you go and visit the Forensic Science Services right now, you'll see a number of those departments or a number of those machines are switched off. They're not running. And that is because they haven't been maintained, and therefore they won't operate them. And those are the questions that, again, maybe the portfolio committee can ask the Forensic Science Services: how many of your machines are not operating as a result of you not having maintenance contracts or consumables, if they are maintained, to actually run through those particular machines. From a board perspective, we can't get too involved in the operational, because we are already limited in terms of the time that we can allocate to these particular issues, but we can identify them, bring them forward to you, make recommendations, which we have, to the minister, to say, please will you give more budget to the Forensic Science Services in order for them to do the job that they need to do. So that's in terms of the maintenance. In terms of the procurement, I think I have, and I hope I have answered questions with regards to the complex structure, and certainly, again, if they're only awarding, for instance, a 3-month contract, that we're going to keep running into those issues. So possibly going forward, all of these contracts that are being awarded by supply chain management, and maybe for the next board, they need to see how long they've been awarded for, because these processes, maybe in terms of renewing them, need to be set in place much earlier, so that you have an overlap as opposed to a big 2-year gap between having supply kits and not having supply kits. And you're absolutely right, every single person who leaves a rape survivor or a rape crisis centre who hasn't had evidence taken from them potentially means that that person can attack again, and also means that you have a person who has already had a terrible ordeal and then can't even have evidence taken in order to identify who that perpetrator is. It's an unacceptable situation that mustn't be ever allowed to happen again. And then in terms of the legislation maybe that you've suggested, the outgoing board must present a paper, and hopefully you'll be able to present it to the minister as well as to the portfolio committee, in terms of the recommendations for improvements to the Act. That is the only mandate that we have, is to make recommendations. Thereafter, the minister has to either enact them and follow our recommendations as the experts, as why we have been appointed to this board, and the portfolio committee need to ensure that it's followed through, and if not, an explanation given as to why our recommendations haven't been followed. But that's as far as we can take it in terms of the board's mandate. In terms of the end of the term, and I think the same question was what has been done. I think I'm going to ask one of the direct questions to you, Deputy Minister, seeing as though he's sitting next to us.
I thought I had to ask the question.
No. We are talking this
same language. If you have an issue that you want clarity, you can mention it in passing, but you can't ask
the
question.
The question that was raised.
There is a member of the board. There is a chairperson of the meeting. No, earlier I allowed you to. You do not delegate to your chairperson. You do not ask your chairperson to speak. There's a chairperson of your board. You tell me that your chairperson is going to continue. I see there's a chair of this meeting. So you do not tell your deputy minister to speak.
Please,
we have been extremely patient. And we continue to be extremely patient.
My sincere apologies. I'm terrible with protocol, and I do apologize for not following it. As I said, as a civilian, I often don't know what the protocols are, and apologies if I have offended you. I'm going to answer the question with regards to the, and this is where I was going with it, with regards to the amendment.
Honourable Deputy
Minister. Must I answer the question with regards to the amendment?
I've given the Deputy Minister.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah, no, I thought the Chair was raising a procedural matter. It's not about offence, and I thought it must be understood in that context, and we should agree that we should conduct ourselves procedurally, and so that we don't get confused in the process. I thought I must say that, Chair, thank you.
Okay, apologies, it was going to be discussing around the amendment recommendation because I didn't know if it needed to be repeated, but I won't repeat the question. I will just answer it in terms of when it comes to the end of the term, one of the questions is what has been done and what are we going to do to follow through with it. So in terms of the regulations, when we leave, we have made a recommendation to have the regulations amended. We have done a lot of work in terms of recommending it. It now is with the state law advisors, and the minister needs to look at it and either sign it or not sign it. If that comes back by the time our term is ended, then it will probably need to be taken over by the next committee in terms of where that goes. In terms of the amendment to the Criminal Procedure Act, we have put together an amendment that we believe is correct, which will be now given to the minister, and the next committee will then have to follow that through in terms of whether they agree with it, in terms of that recommendation, and whether they want to pursue the line that we have in terms of how it must go forward in terms of the sampling of the convicted offenders. In terms of supply chain management, again, on the as we are outgoing, we have done as much as we can in terms of ensuring that that supply chain management has been signed and that kits are going to be delivered, and the new on the committee, the recommendation would be just to ensure that those numbers actually are delivered in terms of what has been promised. In terms of the MOU, the judge has already said that if we don't aren't able to sign that MOU or agree on it before we leave, our recommendation would be the new proposal. Alternatively, if that isn't agreed to, then a new board will be appointed in terms of the Act, and that will continue as it is. And I think that was all in terms of that question, unless there's something that I have missed out. And then there was a question around how we oversee maladministration and corruption. I think, as I've explained, is that when we are notified of various, such as that supply chain management and evergreen contracts, we try and bring those bodies in front of us to understand what the issues are, and then we make recommendations going forward. So for instance, with a code of agreement, they'll say that hasn't been signed, all we can do is say, please get together and make sure that you talk about it. But we can't get involved operationally. The police stations, we were asked how many police stations, have they got rape kits? The appointment of the deputy director, we envisaged that particular person to go and make sure that in looking at the numbers that are given to us, that they actually do spot checks on police stations, maybe see how many kits are at those particular police stations, report back to the boss or her boss, which will be the director, to say, I've been to various police stations, this is what I found. It does or doesn't match up with the information that we're receiving from the forensic science services. And in that way, that sort of gaps analysis will take place in terms of actually on the ground level, understanding if what has been told to us by the various departments, such as supply chain management, actually occurring at ground level. And if it's not occurring at ground level, then obviously that will be another intervention that the board would make a recommendation to say, why haven't these kits actually been delivered? So I'm just trying to give you an understanding of how far we can take our mandate in terms of following through on issues that we identify. So often we are not responsible for providing the actual solutions, or rather for enabling the solution, but we can make recommendations which we feel will provide a solution, and then we have to rely on those stakeholders to follow up our recommendations so that the solutions are in fact carried out. But that's as far as we can take it in terms of our particular mandate. Where are the rape kits? Well, as I said, that's the only information that we have now, and then possibly that is something that we could procure for our final report in terms of numbers, because we do get those numbers every time we meet. We were supposed to have met today as a board, and then after that we were going to meet with the Forensic Science Laboratory. That meeting would then give us that. So what they would do is they would say, supply chain management would always come to those meetings, and they would say, these are the police stations, these are the provinces, these are the number of buffer sample kits received, these are the number of rape kits received. And through that we can identify where the problems are, and for instance they'd say, yes, we have now had X amount delivered, and another amount will be delivered in December. But that information obviously we haven't been able to get today. One of the members mentioned a workshop with all stakeholders, which I think is an excellent idea, because as soon as it becomes a finger-pointing exercise and saying, well, you didn't do this or you didn't do that, when in fact supply chain management can't deliver the kit because the bid adjudication committee didn't award the tender because SCOPA were investigating the applicants. So if you have everybody in the same room who all can understand what their priorities are, and to facilitate it, that may going forward be a solution. And I don't know if the portfolio committee has the mandate to bring all of those activated members or those stakeholders into one room. I think that going forward that would always be a good solution, because what we have found at the board is that it's never just one particular department or one particular area that isn't affected by another area, and often you need everybody to work together in respect of that. I spoke about the specs of the buffer kits. The training of the police officers isn't done by police, it's actually done by health. Because you're dealing with tissue samples, which are bodily samples, it has to be under the Department of Health, and you have to have health practitioners or registered health workers who do the training, because you are dealing with it. So they can't do it at the police station unless they have one of these registered health providers doing the training. We haven't encountered, other than the fact that the sample kits haven't been available, in terms of overseeing the training, that's actually gone quite smoothly. They have appointed service providers, external service providers who provide this. And I think currently there are almost 20,000, probably just over 20,000 investigators and police officers throughout South Africa who have been trained. And one of our recommendations is now to activate that Section 36D, which says that it's mandatory for all convicted offenders, suspects or arrestees to be sampled, because we believe they have enough representation nationally at all the different police stations to sample the arrestees. So that's just in terms of training. And I think those were all the questions. I don't know if there are any outstanding questions that between the judge and I we haven't covered. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to the board, Judge Mohan.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. I think there was a recurring question regarding why the MOU has not been finalized yet. Honourable Sir Branch, you asked, what does it take to finalize an MOU? You know, when we presented our, or briefed the committee with our 2017-2018 report. That report was filled with what Honorable Malekwa called complaints. And the board sent us back. It's exactly what this Honorable Board did with Honorable Judge Pomus, committee last week, and said just to sit down with us and resolve your issues. And we did exactly that through a strategic exercise. And that exercise came out of the MOU. So the MOU, Honorable, was exactly to try to resolve those tensions that we had. And considering that we are a part-time board, we cannot always call meetings and discuss these critical issues in a meeting. What we do to mitigate our difficulties is we communicate via email. We have this proposal circulated via email, and we ask members to give their inputs. So we have a final draft of the MOU. We are due to have a meeting where we will agree that the MOU represents the issues that we have agreed on as our strategic planning exercise. So all we need to do is to sign it. The reason why it is not finalized is because it has not yet been signed. So after our meeting, as soon as we agree, it will probably be signed. So we have a document that will serve as a blueprint on how to operate in a way that deals with the tensions that we have in the past experience. But as you say, this is not a permanent solution. It cannot be a permanent solution because what the government is not sustainable permanently. And for that reason, we thought we will come up with the new proposals that we have alluded to. So I hope all the members who have raised that issue have been responded to. And Madam Chair, I think there are outstanding issues that Mr. Rapia wants to respond to, and our two other members also want to respond to, because they are experts in a particular area, through you, Madam Chair, and hopefully briefly. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Mukuru. Mr. Rapia.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. It's two questions that I just want to respond to. It's about the plans put in place to appoint another board. The minister has tasked the civilian secretariat to advertise for the new board, and the advert will be going out this weekend. And the comment about managing transition, I think we note that, and we have to make sure that in the process of appointing that we don't lose that. I think it's an important point that the honorable members have raised, which we have to make sure that in consultation with the minister that the transition is managed effectively. There was also a question regarding the remuneration level of the deputy director, and also if the person has been appointed, and whether we really need this resource. We do need this resource, because it's a skill that we've never had before, and we don't have this skill in the department currently. The deputy directors are remunerated plus minus 800,000 per annum. The person has been appointed, and we expect that person to start on the 1st of December. Thank you. That's all.
Any other members from the board?
follow-up question?
Chair, one existing question and one follow-up. The existing question relates to correctional services. I believe Mr. Rogers was going to provide us with that information. And that information is quite critical for us to understand the extent of the problem that we are faced with. And I think it's really important that the Deputy Minister hears that firsthand as well while he's with us today. The follow-up question, Chair, is whether the Civilian Secretariat will bring the applications to this committee. So that this committee may have sight of the applications, that we are satisfied that the new board constitutes a sufficient level of expertise and experience in the field of DNA.
Thanks, Honourable Chair. Honourable Butchfield, I think as you would recall, initially there was a bit of discrepancy in the figures that were provided by the Forensic Science Laboratory and the DCS, but ultimately the figures that were given to you by Advocate Bell was the final figures that we were able to reconcile, because there were different spreadsheets that were given to us, and we had to clean up that data, but the 44,000, I think, or odd that you, yeah, 46,000 that you referred to earlier, that was the final figure that was given to us, because one of the initial reasons why the minister also decided to put it on hold was because there was this discrepancy in the figures, and he felt uncomfortable putting the ball before JCP's cabinet if we didn't have the correct figures. So he put it on hold, and he sent us back to make sure that we have the correct figures. So if it, essentially what he wanted was to have a look at what was the total convicted offender population at the start of the 2 year transitional period, and what was the total number left over at the expiry date, and how many had the samples taken, and we kind of had to work that out. But in doing that, there was a bit of challenges because of one of the issues that the Deputy Chair referred to earlier in terms of the interoperability between the different systems and the way the data had been recorded. So that took a bit of time in cleaning up that data, but ultimately the 46,000 figure that you got was the final figure.
Sorry, the second part of the question, there were two parts to that question. One was the total number, right, that are untested. I accept that, thank you. The second part of the question was whether we know how many people have actually been released that are untested.
That, unfortunately, I don't have the answer to that at the moment. No. So we would have to get that information from DCS, and we can always provide it back to the committee.
Any further follow-up question? Could I just make the following observation? This is, we understand that this is a program and not an entity. But the concern I have is that since the establishment, I have not seen any strategic plan or annual performance plan or documents. I tried to go into the history, and my research has not provided me with any strategic plan. I asked the content advisors, they could not provide me with any strategic plan or annual performance plan. Which means that I have no idea what your strategic objectives are, what your indicators are, what your targets are for the financial year. And this then questions the structure and the uniformity in the manner in which the board executes its mandate. The board ultimately reports to Parliament on a quarterly and annual basis. And these reports have been late. So could we get an explanation why these reports are late? Why we have no service delivery model which sets out your objectives and how you're going to achieve those objectives.
the minister's instructions regarding the submission of the APP for 2018-2019. Minister raised this. And then Mr. Rapia, we expected that part of the civilian secretariat report would include the report of the different programs which we had. So we were expecting that the DNA board's report would be part of the civilian secretariat's annual report. So could we get an explanation as to why we had these shortcomings? These shortcomings, because we have to place what it is you do, we distinguish between your functions, what is functional. We keep on saying that this is an operational matter. But if we listen to you very carefully, then you do not distinguish between what is functional, what is operational, and what is administrative. It's very blurred. We keep on saying that, oh, no, 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 this is operational. But you have a very blurred idea of what is operational, what is functional, and what is administrative independence. So I don't think we want to listen to your articulate things. We want to see this in your structure. And if you do not have an annual performance plan, then how do we see this in your structure? How are we able to monitor this? Now, you come to us and you say to us that there are certain things you want the minister to note, and you've noted this. And you have the minister now, the deputy minister, in your presence. So we are not the conduit for your messages to the minister. We have to do oversight, and our oversight is based on the strategic plan, the annual performance plan, and our oversight is a very in this regard, Honorable Victor. We have asked a number of questions on this ranking. And I have a serious concern because a number of the answers we have received are different to what we are today. So the answers we have received from the questions we asked to the minister and the department in my and your presentation has given us no perspectives of what is happening. Which is a concern.
Chair, just the question I directed about the application.
Yes, I haven't forgotten about it. Any further, giving the other members an opportunity to ask perhaps, for example, Joseph?
Thank you, Chair. It's not a follow-up, maybe a ratification. When I said entities, I did not mean that it was called supply chain. I was speaking mainly on entities that form the Department of Police, all of them, so that they must speak to each other, because I raised the question of where there are no police stations, what happens in terms of the red kit, which means the community at that particular place, they don't then have those things, because now they must report their cases in different areas where there's a jurisdiction of the police. So that is how I was raising it. That is the concern that I have, that these entities seem not to speak to each other and complement one another. That is why I was raising it. I was not speaking in terms of the supply chain.
Thank you, Judge.
Madam Chair, can I ask Mr. Rapia and our director to respond to those formal questions about the strategic plan and the APP and the lateness of our reports.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Thank you, Judge. Regarding the APP and strategic plan for the first time, you know, APP 19-20, we have included the indicators for the DNA board. In the past, that's why you wouldn't have that in your report. They were not there. So it will be in the next year's annual report that the civilian secretariat will be reporting on the work of the DNA board. regarding the applications, I don't know if I understand the question well, but the minister is supposed to come and table the appointments, the board members, those who the minister has appointed, not at the time when they submit their application, but the appointed board members, the minister tables it to parliament and to this portfolio committee. And once that is done, it will be tabled accordingly.
I don't know. I'm not sure whether Mr. Rapia, what that is the interpretation of the law. I'm not sure whether I hear you well, because it's like you are saying the minister will table to parliament and to the committee, and thereafter it will become the board. Is that what you are saying?
According to the Act, the minister has the power.
Absolutely.
This board is appointed by the minister.
Because
the parliament has got the National Assembly and the portfolio committee do not have any jurisdiction over the appointment of this board.
What I hear the committee to be saying, which I think that is what they are saying. They are not saying bring the application. The committee is saying have the necessary expertise in the court. The same way as I think this board has the necessary expertise. I think that's what was being raised. Of course, the information you will get ultimately, but the process, the process I think, we must follow the law in the appointment of the board, let me put it that way, and that it must be based on experts in the field.
Thanks, Chairperson. I can clarify this question. I understood Mr. Rapier to be on the same page as the Deputy Minister that the appointments will come to Parliament after they've been made. My question was understood partly by the Deputy Minister, which was to ensure that the board has sufficient expertise, not that the committee can decide on who's appointed to the board, but that is the, perhaps this is the way to ask the question. Does the legislation prevent this committee, is it unlawful for this committee to see the applications for information so that the committee is not acting on an ex post facto basis once the board is appointed? I mean, we can't prevent the minister from appointing the board. What I'm trying to exercise is this committee's authority to hold the executive to account through transparency, that there is an element of mutual cooperation between parliament and the minister, not that the committee gets to decide who is appointed. That is absolutely the purview of the minister, that's fine. We're going to have a similar battle with the appointment of the head of IPED, Chairs. That the minister has tremendous authority to do that. Fine, that's in the law. But to what extent does the committee get to conduct oversight over the application process? And perhaps it's a subject for discussion on another day. but certainly not a discussion that I'm going to allow to end here, because I think that we need to just figure out what our role really is then, because we may get a board that is constituted and the committee doesn't believe that there's been sufficient expertise, or that the application process was, for whatever reason, not sufficiently inclusive. Thank you.
Could we say the following? We do not want transparency to compromise the appointment process. Mm-hmm. We should not allow the expectation that this presentation should be transparent, and in effect we are compromising the powers as stipulated in the law of the minister. So there's in no way do we want to overstep the powers of the committee and undermine the powers of the minister. But We take cognizance of the fact that there is a process for a new board to be appointed, and that, as the committee member said, we want a smooth transition from the existing board to the new board, and that the handover process should also be facilitated by the minister. We would want, as a committee, ensure that there's no gaps between the outgoing board and the incoming board. The committee commended the board for its presentation and appreciated the depth of expertise, and considered this one of the best presentations we have received since we started as a committee in this administration, which is a very difficult compliment to Honorable Judge and your team. And we'd like to commend you for that. And thank you for holding the fort. This is a very difficult area. With the emphasis on gender-based violence, I think the work has become more central to what it is we do in the civilian sector. So your work shouldn't be left in the shadows. It should be highlighted and sent, and it should become a more critical point of what it should go to become. And that should be regarded as one of your achievements. We cannot prescribe to the minister who to appoint. In fact, we could certainly recommend to the minister that there should be continuity and that we shouldn't just forget about the specialist and the experience which has been built up in the board. Honorable Hodges, please, wanted to add.
Yes.
Yes, before you conclude, I could see that there's
no.
Okay, I thought you were
conclude. On this matter, no.
Oh.
I'm giving you all an opportunity because you have been very open.
Thank you, Chair. No, this one is a concern, Chairperson, it's not a question. I could hear when the board was responding to the questions that they can only go up to a certain point in terms of other issues that are affecting actually the secretariat, the board that they are in. In for instance, in terms of the rape kit, that now there was a problem with supply chain and so forth, and I would understand that in the board, maybe you would have subcommittees where there's the, where you deal with your ethnics and stuff and whatever. So where do these people report to? And if we come here, it's a concern, Chairperson, that I'm raising. I want, because the DM is here, he should also hear this. Because when they come here as a board and present to us, this is how far we have went, and we can't go beyond what we have done, then I seem to have a problem, because then where do these people report to? And when they report, who takes the responsibility? Because when they are here, they take the responsibility of the entity. So we want to then know of the DNA board. We want to then know what we then want to know who are the responsible people, because this has financial implications in it. And it will come a report where it says this is how much was supposed to be spent, and vis-a-vis what has been supplied through the police stations, and you'll find that it does not balance the two. So I just wanted to check the chairperson. It's just a concern that I have, because I could hear when they were responding that there seemed to be a red tape somewhere. No one will then come to the board and take responsibility of what has been done. But when they come here, they come as the board, they must take responsibility of something that they cannot go beyond. That is the clarity that I would want to know, maybe from the DM.
And before I give a chance, Dean, Honourable Member Mahoney, you're happy?
Thanks, Chair. DM, there's a slide there that says the significant decline in the number of cases registered and finalized can be linked to the shortage of every collection kits and consumables. And that is where they say there is a lack of resources placed on them as well. So I'd like the DM to intervene in that aspect as well. Because now it leaves more gaps for criminals, you know, to have a leeway, because they'll be released in a manner that is not conducive to the matter. Thanks.
Honourable Member Shandin.
I'm covered.
Thank you. Muleko. Okay. Honourable Dean.
Yeah, no, thanks. The board reports to the minister, and the minister has asked the DM to be responsible for entities. There must never be a situation where in the board it's like it's helpless. They can't do anything about the situation. The issues must be raised, and in this case, I must be informed, and I must respond accordingly to the issues that they have raised, so that they don't have a problem, including misunderstanding. There is an item where they have written misunderstanding between a memorandum of understanding with the civilian secretariat. All these are part of the department. The board has a specific function to do. The secretariat have a specific responsibility to do, which are not in conflict with each other. So such things should be resolved. When we come here, we must come here to report on what we are doing, the progress we have made, areas we have challenges, but we can't come here and present a problem that is supposed to be resolved then. Like, for instance, you can feel that the deputy chair has an issue that she wanted to raise, and she couldn't get hold of me, and now she was fortunate that I'm here, and now she must ask me the question. Yeah, I must ask you a question, Deputy Minister, which I think you must ask me outside the meeting, and then we must attend to that. The supply chain, every in the police service, in our work, whatever we do, whether it's the board, for them to be effective in what they do, they need the tools of trade to work with. These tools of trade must be procured. And procurement is done by the South African Police Service, by the police. There is a unit that deals with the supply chain, there is a contract management and all those. And we have picked up a challenge there, and we are dealing with the challenge. And this challenge played itself out around the rape kit. I think you know that there was a big problem around rape kits, and we had to meet over a weekend to deal with this problem. And seated here now, I think we've been able to resolve the problem. Because as we speak, rape kits are being delivered. The FCS units, all of them have the rape kits with them. I don't want to say all the police stations have received by now, because it was something that the process of delivering was ongoing. But what we know is that all provinces have come to collect the kits centrally in head office, and they are being distributed. So they might not have reached all the stations. There were issues around, ammunition. The bullets, which has been resolved, but generally there were problems in supply chain. Last week we had a meeting with the leadership of the South African Police, where we discussed this matter. We also brought on board an outside expert who we thought can help us with the management of supply chain, because there is a problem, and it has played itself out. But I think that is a matter that we will be able to resolve as the leadership, both at the political level and administratively. And I believe going forward, supply chain will not continue to be a problem that it has been. It has been a very serious problem, I must concede. But we are dealing with that. The other issue that I thought I was raised, which I think I must not say it's unfortunate, because I don't know why the honourable member is raising it, that we don't seem to be taking the committee seriously as both the minister and the deputy minister. That the ministry is not taking the portfolio committee seriously. I thought we were taking this committee seriously. And since we came in, we have from time to time tried to attend almost all the meetings that have been called, unless there are circumstances where we are unable to attend because we are not around. Like I think it's last week or week before last, I was not able to attend, because I was given an emergency assignment to go and deal with in the Northwest. And as a result, I couldn't come to the portfolio committee. But where possible, we do come. Sometimes we even apologize to attend cabinet for purposes of being available here for the committee. Today, unfortunately, we had to go to the cabinet first, and then we came to join you here. That is the seriousness that we show to the committee. And when we are given responsibilities by the committee, we have responded accordingly, which does not suggest we don't respect this committee. We do. And if we behave in a manner that suggests that we don't respect this committee, it was not intentional. Thank you.
Thank you very much, dear. Judge, if you still have any outstanding matters?
I seem to think, thank you, Jefferson. I seem to think, Honourable Whitfield asked the question whether members of the board are remunerated to ask a question. Thank you. And Madam Chair, can I ask our CFO to answer that question? Because it cannot be answered. Some financial other intricacies which apply. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. Maybe maybe answering to the question, I would like to say that yes, they are remunerated. There are forms which they need to complete, like any other person, for whatever meeting that they attend, and then we actually refund them. The only people that will not be remunerated is those people that are working for the public service. Thank you.
And those who don't work for the public service. And also are not remunerated
for the meetings they attend. The chairperson is the only person who's not remunerated. Hi. Isn't it the chairperson is a retired judge, which is actually remunerated through the justice department? So that is the understanding that we have. That's why the chairperson is not.
I think let us not go into this matter now. We'll leave that to you, Deputy Minister, because it is your responsibility. Honourable members, let us accept day one. And we had this discussion with the Chief Whip that Tuesdays and Wednesdays in particular, of cabinet day. Our meetings are mostly scheduled for a Wednesday. So every alternative Wednesday there is a cabinet committee, and the deputy minister and the minister attend cabinet committee. Unfortunately, Wednesdays are the days allocated to us for portfolio committee meetings. And Wednesdays, every second Wednesday is a cabinet meeting, and the minister must attend that cabinet meeting. When we have committee meetings, we have, I think we have had the highest representation of either the minister or the deputy minister when it comes to portfolio committees, as they've been reported to the chief. So we're not comparing apples with pears and which committees that had ministers or deputies. I'm not comparing with other portfolios. But we need to say that the minister and the deputy minister prioritize the portfolio committee. It is a tough portfolio for the minister, and I'm not making excuses for the minister, but the deputy minister has consistently been in our meetings, and I've raised it every time the deputy minister comes. I've made a point of saying the deputy minister is here, and we understand you, that you're coming to us after you have presented your item to cabinet committee, and that you can only leave after you have presented your items. But this does not take away the importance of you being here, and of course the committee does have a responsibility to exercise its oversight role. We have requested that we meet with the Portfolio Committee of Women next week, Tuesday on the 19th, members, because this is a joint meeting with other portfolio committee meetings. They've indicated that this meeting starts at 9. So if this, if the time of this meeting changes, it will not be us. We have to inform ministers, deputy ministers, and the members individually, so that we don't have a problem with the arrangement of this meeting. The Committee of the Gender-Based Violence of the Presidency will be reporting to us in the meeting. If we do not have any further business, Honorable Judge Mukoro, it was good to see you again. Robin, take Mrs.
Between you and me, I'm going there.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Honourable members of the board, I've already complimented you and commended you for a very good presentation. And
thank you very much for a job well done. Mr. Rafia and your team, thank you very much for a job well done.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Thank you to all the members for the questions that they raised. We shall also motivate us towards looking into some of the issues we might have overlooked. Thank you so much.
And Chairman, I want to hear next week my apologies for the defender.
Thank you. Thank you.
What a fun, you are down.
Yeah, I'm